Okay, members, the Delta Stewardship Council is called to order for purposes of establishing a quorum. And starting with Ms. Gray, please identify yourself.
And Gloria Gray, here.
Felicia Marcus, here.
Fiorini, here.
Eisenberg, here. We have a quorum. Supervisor Natoli's walking in the door. So we have five members of the council. We're going to start with the activity. Roll call is established. Just a couple of things, members. I would like to call your attention, if you haven't read the gloomy fiscal news that appears on the front pages of the newspapers today, I strongly recommend you do so. To the surprise of not many people, the budget for the state of California for the next 18 months is out of whack by about $13 or $14 billion. That is not unexpected. But what is a bit unusual is that if those figures hold up through the end of December, they will automatically trigger budget reductions, including reductions in education of somewhere between $2 and $4 billion, with the implications that are out there. It is worthy of consideration. Also, you received a notice earlier this week that we have selected a chief deputy executive officer of the Delta Stewardship Council, and interrupting his phase out of 30 days at the Department of Parks and Recreation, Mr. Ray is here, and I wonder if you could wave at people and maybe even come up to take a seat here. We'll be seeing you a lot.
Stop by and reintroduce myself. I'm really thrilled to be able to join your team here. And some of these folks are old friends of mine, and others are folks that I've known over the last just couple of years. And, I've had a long tenure at the intersection of water and natural resources management and planning, so I appreciate the tests that could be anticipated and the great work you're doing. There's nothing more important in California right now, and I'm happy to be part of the program. Thank you very much.
Yeah, members, you're going to remember that, 2 months ago, you were here presenting the Department of Parks and Recreation plan, Delta plan,
recreation proposal,
to us, and that was the last presentation. Well, we look forward to a long and fruitful relationship, and we appreciate your coming on board. Mr. Grindstaff, you want to weigh in with anything on this particular issue?
Just that I'm thrilled to have Dan coming.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay, members, let's go to Agenda Tab 4, the Executive Officer's Report. Mr. Grindstaff, if you'd walk us through the various items.
Well, let's start off with the legal update. And Chris?
Thank you, Joe. I'd like to introduce once again our legal expert, Curtis Keller from UC Davis, who's going to provide you an update on some cases that are not the Delta Smelt and salmon cases that we always comment on and provide updates on. But before Curtis gets into that, I'd just like to bring to your attention the fact that this is going to be Curtis's last appearance before you. He's going to be finishing up his career at UC Davis and then taking the bar and moving on to bigger and better things.
Possibly.
After this.
Hopefully.
Yeah, after this externship. Perhaps, I don't know, but I did want to say publicly that he did a fantastic job to thank Felicia and Phil for generating the interest in our agency, which was fantastic, and to thank UC Davis Law School Externship Program for allowing you to come. You did a great job, and so now with that, go ahead.
Thank you, Chris. Good morning, Chairman Eisenberg and council members. It's a pleasure to be before you again. So this morning, I'd like to update you on a few case developments which are relevant to the Delta and could have future implications there. The first is the Delta Wetlands lawsuit. Central Delta Water Agency last month issued a challenge to the EIR adopted by Semi-Tropic Water Storage District. The subject of that EIR was a Delta Wetlands project. That project, as proposed, would fill in two Delta islands into reservoirs and an additional two, turning them into habitat islands. This isn't the first time that we've seen this project, nor is it the first time that Central Delta has challenged this project. Back in 2004, Central Delta successfully had the water permits for the project set aside, and in an important decision, the court held that EIRs and the CEQA process for water permits had to give specific uses and amounts of water rather than the general statement that the water was to go to beneficial use. So this time around, the Delta Wetlands Group, which is a private corporation, teamed up with Semitropic to...
A water district based in...
Excuse me.
Where is it located?
Delta Wetlands is not a water agency.
I know, but Semitropic is.
Is a water storage district.
In Kern County.
Yeah. I mean, just for background on this.
Thank you, Chairman.
Yeah.
The proposed, the new EIR was to rectify those past deficiencies in the prior EIRs, to rectify the issue of the specific amount of use and the place of uses. And so that EIR addresses those issues. However, the Central Delta has alleged other deficiencies, including insufficient analysis of the effect on other Delta levees, the ecological ecosystem harms caused by the proposed project, as well as the detriment to the Delta economy, as well as other procedural defects. So that case is being heard in San Joaquin Superior Court, and so we'll keep you abreast, seeing as it had a great impact the last time it was heard.
Is there a hearing date set?
Not to my knowledge yet.
Well, we've got some other people in the audience.
Yeah, and they might be able to speak better to it than
okay.
I could. Second, the other set of cases are the area of origin cases, and I use plural because there are both federal and state cases on this issue. The first, on the federal side, the Tahama Calusa Canal Authority case being heard by Judge Wanger prior to his retirement from the federal bench. In early August, he had issued a ruling that that CVP water contractors could not invoke the state area of origin laws in receiving their water from CVP. He cited a few sources.
Well, the request was that in the event of a shortage, they were requesting that their use of federal water be fully satisfied first before any water could be transferred to others, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. Judge Wanger held that priority could not be asserted by federal water contractors, citing the theory that the priority is an inchoate right, that it cannot be invoked without first perfecting a water right under state law, which is not the case with Tahama, as well as other federal statutory language, such as that the water is to be used for the broadest public benefit or widest public benefit. So that case is on appeal at the Ninth Circuit, and we'll keep updated on that development. But on the state side, a case that is pending in Sacramento Superior Court with the same type of issue being that contractors with the state water project are asking to invoke the same area of origin priority. And DWR in that case using the same argument that was accepted on one side in the federal court, that the right is inchoate and that that the water rights have not been perfected through state law, that they should not be able to invoke that right.
What does it mean, water rights have not been perfected?
That they haven't gotten any water permit through the State Water Resources Control Board.
Okay, so area of origin requires them that the water board hold hearings, do whatever it's going to do, and quantify or establish that right?
That's the theory being asserted by DWR in that case.
Okay.
In 2006, and as the state water contractors are alleging in this case, and in an important decision, the State Water Resources Control Board issued by Justice Roby said that it may be possible for state water contractors to invoke that area of origin priority even under contracts with the state water project. But the trial court in Sacramento has dismissed motions for summary judgment, at least alleging that there are tribal issues of fact on that issue, and so that will go forward. And it should be a rather large case with interveners on both sides coming in. And so will be something to definitely keep an eye on as well. Okay. Moving on, the next case that we want to mention is the at issue is agricultural runoff in the valley. And just last week, a lawsuit was brought by a coalition of environmental and fishing groups under the Clean Water Act in federal court. At issue is the grassland.
Federal court in Fresno? East?
That's correct, in the Eastern District. Mm-hmm. The at issue is the grassland bypass project, which drains agricultural runoff, heavy in selenium and other contaminants, from West San Joaquin County farmland. They run through project ditches and canals, including the San Luis drain, and then it goes out into the delta through the mud slough, a tributary to the San Joaquin River. They use this route rather than to drain into wildlife refuges where contamination was being seen back in the
80s. This involves the grasslands as well as other areas
yes,
down there?
Yes, there are other groups involved. At issue is the coalition of plaintiffs is claiming that under the Clean Water Act, any contaminants or pollutants being drained into national navigable waters must be permitted, and in this case, there is no permit issued. The contest on the other side is that there has been an extension. Rather than meeting the 2009 deadline for eliminating all contaminants in the runoff, that was extended between the San Luis Mendota Water Authority and the Bureau of Reclamation, giving them an extension until 2019 to get the runoff clean from.
And that was tied to the agreement they reached that included grasslands.
That's
and
correct.
Other,
okay. That's correct. Yeah. And so that extended the project, and the project was included by the Water Resources Control Board in their 2010 Water Basin Plan. And it was that acceptance that spurred the litigation that we're discussing right now. And so that will move forward, as I said, in Fresno in the federal district courts. And then lastly, just and briefly, in the levee policy that's going through with the removal of trees, note that the California Department of Fish and Game has joined into that lawsuit after a time of discussing with the Corps engineer of the Corps of Army Engineers about that policy. They've decided to join that suit, obviously citing the detriments to the ecosystem around the San Joaquin and Sacramento rivers, and then obviously flowing into the delta, damages to that ecosystem will have likely effects into the delta. So that will be something also to keep in the mirror. So.
Okay. Questions? Felicia.
Has it been a good experience working with Chris?
Absolutely.
You can tell me later.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, and thank you for giving us your time during the internship. We appreciate it very much. Okay, Mr. Grindstaff.
Yes, a couple of other things to bring up. One is the work sessions. We had planned to have a work session this week, but there were inevitable problems, unavoidable problems, so we have a work session on covered actions scheduled for the 28th. Between 1 and 4 in our building on the second floor. So that will be occurring on the 28th.
And that is noticed in the electronic newsletter that was posted on our website today, right?
Yes, it is noticed there, and we'll send out a separate notice to make sure that everybody is aware of that. But we have that specific work session that people wanted us to follow up on covered actions. And if there are others, we plan to have those either in December or January. So second point I just want to mention, I think I mentioned last month that we had reached agreement on the lifting of a hiring freeze. The Department of Finance asked for a plan for cutting the budget, and we cut the budget, and they agreed based on that plan that we could go about hiring. So for the first time since the council's really been in existence, we've been able to hire some staff. Thus, you have Dan Ray. We've had acting, both Keith and Terry, at one time or another being the acting chief deputy.
Joe, what was my recollection is we had vacant positions we couldn't fill of about 30 or 33% of our total staff. Is that about right?
That's about right. And in particular, we were short in science, where I think we were 40% short, and in the Delta Plan staff, of all places to be short, where we were 70% short. And so that has caused problems, challenges. Hopefully, we'll be able to address those moving forward. So I just put a little summary of some of the positions in here so you could see that and know that we're addressing those issues as we move forward.
Okay. Any questions on that? Okay. Anything else, Mr. Grindstaff?
That's it for me this time.
Okay. Members, if you'd be good enough to turn to the next agenda item. It is the agenda number 5. It's the minutes of the meeting. Are there any comments or questions? I just want to make a couple of notes. As you know, I had a memorial service, so I missed some of the testimony, but I was trying to reconstruct from the minutes the testimony. And some of the people were suggesting that somehow we had the ability to change the law. So one of the parties said we should change the word from promote infrastructure to meet. And I don't know, did we get involved in a discussion explaining that the council is not authorized to change the law on its own?
I don't remember a discussion like that.
All right. Okay. Any questions? Anyone in the audience have a comment on the minutes? Okay. Motion, please.
So moved.
Mr. Natoli, second. Ms. Gray, starting with Ms. Gray, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Eisenberg, aye.
Natoli, aye.
Okay. 5-0 on the minutes. Approved. Okay, item number 6. Our lead scientist, Dr. Dom, is here looking ready for business, although he reports that when he leaves, he might change into jeans just to do work. Doctor?
I'm headed back to co-host a workshop back in New Mexico, and I will go back to my normal attire. Okay, I have 4 items that I'd like to go through with you. Some of them derive from some questions that were asked at the last council meeting. And I basically want to start with a meeting that I had an opportunity to attend in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I'm a little disappointed that Hank isn't here because Coeur d'Alene, Idaho is where he has a home on Lake Coeur d'Alene. Beautiful venue. And this was a meeting of the National Science Foundation's program called the Experimental Program to Stimulate Competitive Research. And this is a program that involves 27 of the states in the United States and 2 territories. It basically is designed to try to improve the science education and the science infrastructure in states that have lagged behind, basically, nationally. And it's a program that's been going on for about 3 decades, and they meet on a regular basis. And this is the national meeting, and I was asked to come and to speak to the issue of water and the environment, which was one of the 3 themes of the meeting. And so I used you all and the effort that you all are engaged in as my presentation. But I was asked at the beginning to actually present some water and environment background material on the EPSCoR states. And so I did that, and I'm going to do the same to you, a little test of your knowledge. The 2 driest states in the United States are EPSCoR states. What are the 2 driest states in the United States? Nevada is one, I heard from the audience. Mm-hmm. The other one is my home state, New Mexico. Okay. Second question I asked them is the states with the 2 highest diversity of freshwater fishes are EPSCoR states. The number of species of freshwater fish. The 2 highest are both states that are in the EPSCoR program. Any ideas where they're located?
No.
Not Idaho? Not the western United States. We're kind of depauperate in fish species. Go to the south, go to the southeast, and those 2 states are Tennessee and Kentucky.
Hmm.
Okay?
Hmm.
All right. The third question that I posed to them is all 5 of the top water consumption states in per capita water use are EPSCoR states. So what 5 states lead the nation in per capita water use? Nevada is not one of them. Number one was the host state. That's why I use this, Idaho. They use a lot of groundwater because of the agricultural. Second is Montana. Third is Wyoming. Fourth is Nebraska. And fifth is Arkansas. So these are states that use a high level of per capita consumption. In fact, I think Idaho pumps as much groundwater as every state in the United States except California and Texas. So so anyway, those are my little sort of get them thinking kind of questions. And then we went on and talked about some of the issues that relate to water and the environment. The title of my talk was Science, Policy, Planning, and Competing Goals in River Management. And I'll be happy to share that, the slides from that, if any of you are interested in it. But the one thing I did want to mention is that the second day was on workforce development in science and engineering. And the third day was focused on energy. And I found the energy session to be particularly interesting because there is a very real interface between water and energy. And there was some significant discussion of that theme. And I think there's been reports out here in California that about 25% of our electrical use goes to either pumping water out of the ground, moving water from place to place, getting ready for drinking it, or treating it after it's been used. And so in a lot of the other western states, a significant amount of the water goes to energy production. And so this issue between the interface between water and energy is something that I think is one area that is growing in attention. I saw Bettina Boxall had a nice article on this very issue on Monday in the Los Angeles Times. And I think it's something that this council, and as time goes on, is going to have to be thinking about, is this interface between water and energy. Our program in New Mexico associated with this EPSCoR program is planning its next five-year effort, and the title is going to be Water, Environment, Energy Nexus. And so we're actually going to try to link those three various components in some of our infrastructure development. So anyway, it was an interesting meeting. It was hosted by Peter Goodwin and the EPSCoR program from the state of Idaho. And
we've heard his name.
Excuse me?
We've heard his name.
I know you've heard his name. So, and they did an excellent job. They really did an outstanding job.
I assume your presentation is accessible through the website contained in the report?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I believe even videos if you get really bored. It
would be helpful, though. Maybe you could ask your folks to give to the council just a copy of the slide presentation you made.
I started out with some specifics about the New Mexico program and then went into some of the efforts that you're engaged in here.
Great.
Okay. The second item that I wanted to talk briefly about was, I think, the byproduct of a discussion that you had during the last council meeting about some of the indices on some of the fish species in the Delta, and there were some questions about how are the salmon doing. And so this is an effort. This is the staff pulled together some information on salmon returns. And so the main points here is that this has been a better year than most in the last 4 or 5 years. Returns are higher in many of the rivers here in California. And certainly they're not up to the same level as they were a decade ago, but they're definitely moving in a direction we'd like to see them moving in. And there's some specifics, I think, in the report on Battle Creek and on the McCollumy and on the San Joaquin.
So as a conclusion, all things considered, we'd rather have more rain than not, although there's a limit to that.
And I think you also have to look to ocean condition as also having been good for the salmon in the last three or four years.
Right.
Randy?
Okay. Cliff, in the report it cites the increase in return on the McCollumy. It associates some benefits to the cross-channel gates being closed. And yet the Stanislaus, the Merced, and the Tuolumne Rivers all seem to be receiving higher amounts of salmon than the previous years. So how much can we attribute to the gates?
Good question. I do not have a good answer for you. It's certainly something that was tested this year, and I think some of the agencies feel like it provided a benefit. It helped route the fish up the system a little more effectively than without the gates closed. Some of the agencies may have much better data as to what that effect was. I'm not really conversant on.
Don?
Yeah, just along the same lines, when will they make a decision whether they would continue to do that coming years? Are they going to obviously analyze whatever they believe the impacts to have been? So is there indicators at this early date that they're going to continue to do that seasonally?
Again, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer. Good question probably to ask some of the fisheries departments as to what if this is something that they feel that there's been enough benefit that they'll consider doing it on a regular basis. That's a very good question, but I'm sorry, I just don't have the information.
And just a follow-on again, and nothing that you'd have the answer either, Cliff, on this, but is there any downside to doing that?
Is there any downside? Again, I'm saying
East Bay Municipal Utility District always makes an observation that they claim they lose some water whenever the gates are closed, and that should be adjusted. And whether they have in the program received adjustments with Bureau, I have no idea in the world.
Yeah,
I remember that
I,
from the
I.
time we held the hearing on the subject last year.
Yes, and it also impacts exports, and so they got agreement this year that they could move ahead with this, and the Bureau agreed to go ahead and do it. I don't know, but by next meeting we can find out how they plan to move forward.
We'll try to follow up on this.
By the way, I just flag an issue which is on the schedule for tomorrow, but agenda item 16 is the report on the fish and game proposed bass changes in bass rules and striped bass fishing rules, and the separate Department of Pesticide Regulation pyrethroid. And in those cases, the same kinds of questions will be asked. Well, we know we've got a challenge, a problem. We have a possible correction, remedy, suggestion. How do you measure success and failure using what people acknowledge is a test or an experiment or something like that? And it's not an easy, I assume it's not easy ever to answer the question, how do you know if you've succeeded or failed?
Although I think, you know, the one thing you can certainly utilize these discussions as a point to sort of try to continue to hammer home, and that is that if we are going to use adaptive management effectively in the Delta, we need to make sure that we design experiments that allow us to get the information to address the kind of questions you're asking me, and that so far I have not been able to answer.
Randy?
Well, I'm expecting that'll be part of the discussion tomorrow.
Yeah.
Correct, Lauren?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. The third item is the one that kept me up last night, and that is how to synopsize accurately and communicate effectively a paper that was recently published, and I believe, Joe, you asked that I try to summarize some of the key points of a paper by Patricia Glibbert and her colleagues that was just published in Reviews in Fisheries Science. This is a 60-page paper with over 400 references in it. Pretty dense going in a very in a topic that she and her co-authors look at it from a variety of different viewpoints. So I'm going to try to sort of summarize some of the key points in this paper. And we'll see how effectively I do this. Please ask questions, because it is an area that I do feel I'm pretty conversant on, but it is not exactly the lightest and easiest of reading, let's put it that way. The concept in the Glibbert paper is that the concept of eutrophication, which is a enrichment of freshwater by the addition of excessive amounts of nutrients, is something that's been studied for a very, very long time. And when nutrients reach levels that are such that they begin to substantively change the types of organisms and the types of processes that are going on in ecosystems, you can have some deleterious effects in freshwater systems. And so there's been examples of eutrophication in all kinds of aquatic systems. They've been studied around the world. The nutrients that are most commonly looked at are nitrogen and phosphorus. You go back to the Clean Water Act in the 60s, it was a determination that phosphorus was having a detrimental effect on a lot of our waterways in both Canada and the United States, that brought about legislation that focused on that. The idea of eutrophication is then one that's been studied for a long time. Parallel concept that has developed more recently is the idea that it's not just how much nutrients the system is receiving. It's also the form and the ratio. I would maybe use as an analogy, does it matter if you got the same number of calories from carbohydrate, protein, or lipid, fat? Would it really change the way the system functions if your diet was all carbohydrate or all protein or all fat? The idea that the elemental stoichiometry plays a significant role is the central premise of this paper. And so the central premise, and I'll quote basically, is that alterations in nutrient stoichiometry, which means basically the ratio of these nutrients, have profound consequences for aquatic food webs. And she uses the San Francisco Bay Estuary as her main study case, using the Interagency Ecological Program data for the last 30 years to look at these issues. But she also brings in examples of work done all over the world that also support some of these basic ideas. And then the paper is then broken up into six major concept sections. And she then goes into a variety of discussion to support the premise that this is a very important part of how food webs are established in aquatic systems. And so she starts out with a definition of eutrophication and how where it's been studied. She talks about this idea of the ratio of the nutrients, what's called ecological stoichiometry, discusses that topic. And then she goes into something that I know Anka has talked to you a little bit about, and that is, can you kick a system into a completely different state by changing the amount of nutrients and the ratio of the nutrients? And this is called alternative stable states, basically.
Alternative what?
Alternative stable state theory is what it is. So she starts out by discussing that and where where the literature and the thinking is on those topics. And then she moves into a discussion of whether or not there has been long-term trends, both in the amount of nutrients and the ratio or the form of the nutrients in the San Francisco Bay Estuary. And the conclusion and the data is quite strong that, yes, there's been significant changes. And the changes in particular for the Bay Delta has been an increase in the loading of nutrients, but also an increase in the ratio of nitrogen to phosphorus. More nitrogen, less phosphorus. Part of that is simply because we've gotten rid of a lot of what used to be the loading of phosphorus because of moving away from phosphorus-based detergents, and also we're a little bit more effective in taking phosphorus out of wastewater. So those are then some of the key points that she makes, and makes, I think, very clear. She shows the trends, and shows the trends are quite clear and quite strong, that there has been this change both in loading amount but also in the form, and it becomes increasing amounts of nitrogen, less phosphorus as time has gone on. Then she goes on to talk about whether or not this is then important for the food web, and there's a large number of correlation analysis between then these changing conditions in the ratio of the nutrients and all parts of the food web. So she's looks at the interaction with the various types of algae that are in the system, the various types of zooplankton that are in the system, the various effects potentially on the fish communities that are in the system. And she also looks at some of the aquatic macrophytes and some of the non-open water systems. And in fact, that's, I think, one of the important contributions of this paper is that she, I think, reminds us very effectively that the delta is not just open water. It has a lot of sloughs and backwaters and edges and things like that, and those have changed substantively. They've changed substantively in the types of organisms that are there, and they seem to be much more indicative of eutrophication being a problem. Are these?
I mean, it's more severe there.
Yeah, you have these huge growths of Egeria and water hyacinth, and you really have some fairly substantive changes in the food web in these backwaters. So after discussing that, she then goes in and addresses whether or not these kind of effects have been seen elsewhere. And she draws in information from Lake Washington up in the Seattle area. She goes to the Chesapeake Bay. She goes to the Potomac River. She goes to the Hudson River. And she goes to a number of places in Europe where these kind of studies have been done, and basically suggesting that her premise is a valid premise. And then she moves on after that to discussing whether or not this is a different view of the San Francisco estuary than is the prevailing view. And she makes the case that it is. And then she makes the case that the multiple stressors that are involved in affecting the system, this is an alternative that would actually focus on the nutrient stoichiometers being one of the leading stressors. And so she has a diagram that basically looks at the current view of the system that, for example, you would get it by looking at interagency ecological program documents versus her idea that this is very that this is a very important factor that structures a system that really starts with the nutrients that are in the system and the ratio of those nutrients. So this is going to be the most controversial part of her paper, and so she has these diagrams that she presents and basically argues that this pathway is a better way of understanding the changes in the system than the multiple stressors interacting that the others have presented. So, and then she ends with some conclusions, and then she actually provides some ideas on how to test these ideas and some of the kinds of experimentation, kind of follow-up research that would be used to actually address whether or not the ideas in her paper are valid. So I think you're going to be talking to a number of people tomorrow about stressors. So you might be interested in querying them as to whether they've read this paper and what their thoughts are. It's just been out for a short period of time, and it is not an easy read in terms of just both the detail and the depth. But I think it has some very interesting ideas that I think we as a science community need to debate, and if there's possibilities of actually moving forward with research that will basically allow us to test some of the hypotheses in here, I think it would be a very good use of resources.
Randy, and then Felicia.
Cliff, it sounds like this is a pretty comprehensive work.
I agree.
Has it been peer-reviewed?
Yes.
Okay. Looking forward, we're in an era of limited resources. The Delta Plan will ultimately have a number of recommendations of actions and things that we believe need to be undertaken to improve water supply reliability and ecosystem health. Not to pin you down, because I asked for this once before, but in that table of stressors that the Independent Science Board created for us several months ago, if we were to pick the top two or three where we would suggest that monies be directed for either further study or action, would this, in your opinion now, be one of the top three issues as far as stressors go?
It would definitely be one of the top five. I mean, I've been asked this question a few times, and I've tried not to be too obfuscatory. I've been trying to give you an answer. I think we have the following issues are clearly important that are worth looking at. And one of them is the issue of flow, and it's not just the amount of flow. It's the timing of the flow, the duration of flow, the rate of change of the flow, some of those kinds of issues. A second one is the habitat issues, and we've talked about that. Another one are some of the contaminants that appear to have direct lethality effects. Another one is nutrients, and I do agree, nutrients is a very important question, and I think it's one that is an important stressor in the system. This is my personal opinion. And then another one that we really, I think, need to think about is this whole, I guess, how would I best explain it? The issue, sort of the fifth one that I really think we need to emphasize is this need to address the landscape connectivity, or the fact that this is a landscape that needs to be looked at, not as a bunch of little pieces on the land, but really we need to look at that land-water interface from a landscape perspective. So those are the kind of my five areas that if we can take a bit of a landscape perspective on the way we approach problem solving in the system, if we could reduce the nutrients in the system, particularly reducing the nitrogen in the system, if we could improve flow conditions in the system, if we could get on with some of these habitat restorations, and if we could get rid of some of these key stressors that are contaminants that we know have some lethality. Those would be the five that I would focus on personally.
Felicia.
Thanks. This is just for the benefit of people in the room and the benefit of people listening who haven't had the opportunity to spend a number of years in EPA and others, I'd like you to do a little bit of translation. Okay. You did a good job from that paper to explaining it in a way that I think many of us can understand, but can you do a couple of things? One is, will you define eutrophication for people? I mean, there's one issue is the robbing oxygen, but there's more to it than robbing oxygen. I see where you're going. If you can define that just for our listeners, and also if you can say where the nutrients come from.
Okay, well, there are many definitions of the word eutrophication. Actually, this morning I looked at a whole bunch of them, and I'll use the one that I think is clearest. And basically, eutrophication is the enrichment of bodies of fresh water by the addition of inorganic nutrients, especially phosphorus and nitrate.
And what do they do to the fish and the food? That I get that, but I don't think people get what impact that has on fish and other organisms.
Well, it's not just on fish. It basically is. It starts at the base of the food web. The nutrients are going to affect the primary production and the decomposition processes in the system. It's that productivity which, if it reaches too high a level, begins then to enhance the decomposition, which then has negative effects mostly through the depletion of oxygen, but also potentially through the quality of the food that is available to the organisms that are in the system and are dependent on the food resources of that system. Another byproduct is
our
harmful algal blooms. Yeah, so changing the algae towards species that are less desirable is another byproduct.
Now, where does the nitrogen come from?
Where does the nitrogen and where does the phosphorus come from? There are two major sources. There are point sources that are basically identified local sources that go into the system, and there are non-point sources. These are distributed and dispersed sources. The non-point sources tend to be urban areas and agricultural areas. The point sources tend to be industrial or wastewater treatment facilities.
And what comes in the form of nitrogen is runoff of fertilizer, as well as stuff that comes out of the wastewater treatment plant and disturbance of the land. Where stuff runs. I'm just trying to make it clear for people who aren't read into the science stuff.
Yes, the sources are many, but you just named some of the key sources. Certainly, there are also localized sources. There are natural sources. This is not. This is an enhancement of a natural process. This is not something that is exotic chemicals. These are chemicals that are in the system. It's just that they've been enriched to a point that they begin to have negative effects.
Right, and in the urbanized area, because you have less permeable or you have more solid surfaces where water runoff can't percolate back into the soil, you end up sweeping things that are on city streets and on other parking lots and all of that into the waterways. So the only reason I raise this is, A, so people will understand it, but, B, then we need to think about what it suggests, if this is one of the top five, in terms of the actions we'll recommend that would reduce the amount of nitrogen running into the Bay Delta.
And certainly the two pathways often utilized are to reduce point source inputs and to use best management practices to reduce inputs from the non-point sources.
Joe.
I want to remind everyone that this council actually took action on this issue last year and authorized Dr. Dom to go appear at the regional board to talk about the need to reduce nitrogen in the system. We didn't have a Delta plan complete, but even then it was apparent that this was one of the key issues. So it is something that we've been focused on. The reason I asked Cliff to do this is because the day after the report came out, Byron Buck handed me the paper and said, Joe, the answer's in here. And some of you that know me know that I was a chemist early in my career, so I actually read it and realized, no, I need to have Cliff read it and try and interpret it so that it could be meaningful for people.
Let me go ahead and end with at least my comments on this paper by reading what the paper authors suggest is the main implication, and that's the following. Remediation of fish populations in the San Francisco estuary will require significant nitrogen reductions to restore the historic ecological stoichiometry balance and the food web. So that's their bottom line.
All these questions are not unexpected given the reaction to her first paper, a year ago, almost a year ago. This obviously advances the discussion of the issue and provides more information. Do you know of any other comparable studies or follow-up things to what she had identified in the report that are underway or likely to be underway?
Sure. There's a number of the things that she suggests would be a pathway forward to addressing some of the ideas and hypotheses in this paper are things that we've already begun to fund through some of the awards that you all approved. Mm-hmm. There are a number of groups that are addressing at least parts of these kinds of these questions. She poses some additional ones that certainly are worth considering but have not yet been initiated. But you know, one of the things that I think made this paper possible, and I want to emphasize this to the council, is that the only reason that a paper of this depth and this high degree of referencing could be done is because of the huge knowledge base that we have available here and the 30-plus years of data on the San Francisco Bay Estuary that allowed this kind of a detailed analysis to be done.
Don.
Cliff, appreciate your certainly summarizing and providing some good important background. And I guess I'm just curious, not a chemist nor a scientist, but is there a, you said there's natural background and or a presence of both nitrogen and phosphorus because of the basic elements that they are. Is there a certain balance that needs to be achieved? And other part of the question is, can you reduce it too much to the point where the processes that are they depend upon are interfered by bringing too much into the system? That's the theory here, and the science is being pursued. But can you go the opposite way? And if so, what results if that were to occur? Not that we're in any chance it's going to happen anytime soon, I don't think, but I'm just curious.
No, actually, there have been example studies of systems where the nutrient supply is so low that the productivity of the system has been deemed to be less than desired, and there have been attempts then to actually set regulatory standards to allow a bit more of certain nutrients to go in. The best one I know of is a study in Canada where there are some of the anadromous fish streams up there that are very, very low in phosphorus, and they've actually agreed that slight enrichments of phosphorus might actually stimulate the food web and actually increase the carrying capacity of those systems. So, yes, this is kind of the example of a lot of things out there in the environment. Too little is not good. Too much is not good. We want to get it at that right level. The one thing that this does is rather than focusing just on amount, they also focus on proportion or ratio. And that's something that is a bit different thinking than just simply dealing with amount.
Yeah, sorry, if I could.
Felicia.
Isn't that like the, and maybe this is totally different, but having seen some of the streams that look crystal clear but are actually sterile because of mine drainage throughout Colorado, that would be an example of where everything's been killed that's in the stream, so there isn't enough for life to live on.
Yeah, but that's a very different pathway. Yeah. I mean, this is an acidification pathway where you've basically gone beyond the physiological tolerances of the organisms and eliminated them. It's different than nutrients where you're basically changing the, changing clearly the production. We know that well, and we're changing the rates of decomposition, which is the issue relative to oxygen, but are we also changing the structure of the community that's there by changing the ratio of these kinds of materials? So, again, it's kind of back to my, I hope it's a reasonable analogy, but say, are you going to get a completely different structure of a population if you feed them all, carbohydrate or all protein or all, all fat? To what extent does the quality of the food matter? And this is certainly what this paper is trying to address and arguing that it matters a lot.
That's a very helpful discussion. For the last 16 or 17 months, we've been circling around this, what I will now call the tentative Cliff Dom list of five, as a way to approach elements of the Delta Plan that we're talking about. And I know you gave that as a tentative, but it's helpful. It's helpful. And when we get to the stressors discussion later, I think we need to start thinking in common terms about this to the extent the science permits us and it makes sense, policy sense. So, good. Yep. And one other report from you.
Yes, I have one other issue, and again, this is one that I think just wanted to provide an update to the council, and that is where are we on the El Nino Southern Oscillation phenomena? And the reason I bring this to bear is that it does have some important effects on precipitation and potentially temperature here in California. I teach a class called Ecosystem Studies, and I actually spend an hour with the students, and I go through the diagnostics that are used to make these kind of predictions, because I think it's important for them to understand where this information is coming from. And the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, through their Climate Prediction Center, on a weekly basis, updates the information that they have at hand, and then issues forecasts as to what they think this means for regional climate. And so I do this, and I pull up the 38 slides that they provide, and I go through the various metrics that they're using and why they're informative, and then try to get them to understand that this is something that, you know, an educated person should be able to understand, and actually has some very useful information. In the southwestern United States, a colleague and I literally in 1990 wrote a paper suggesting that, you know, for better management of our streams and rivers, we need to be aware of what the El Nino Southern Oscillation phenomena is doing, because there's a very strong correlation with our winter-spring precipitation and this and the degree of our snowpack. And so I do this on a regular basis, and I just wanted to sort of highlight a few things. I'll start with the summary of where we are, and that is we have a La Nina has established itself across the equatorial Pacific. We had one last winter, as you probably remember. This one isn't quite as strong. The temperatures are not quite as depressed in the equatorial and eastern Pacific as they were last year. But it is clearly a La Nina again. And so that has some significant implications for precipitation patterns in the United States, and I'll get to those in just a second. The temperatures are about a half degree to a degree centigrade cooler than normal in the central and eastern Pacific, equatorial Pacific. And the atmospheric circulation that then tends to affect is setting up, as you would expect with a traditional La Nina. And the expectation is that this is going to continue through the winter, through basically the rest of this year and the early part of next year. The way that they diagnose the condition of the systems through a variety of measurements, and they include the sea surface temperature, which I've already highlighted. They also look at the structure of the upper 300 meters of the ocean all the way across the tropical and subtropical Pacific. They look at the degree of cloudiness, and that basically the metric is called outgoing long-wave radiation, but it's basically how cloudy it is and where within the equatorial Pacific those clouds are forming. And so this year, with the conditions of really warm water in the western Pacific and cold water in the eastern Pacific, cloud formation is over, you know, around the Philippines and Indonesia and places like that, much less so on this side. So what does this do relative then to some of the things that we would diagnose in a longer-term climate? Well, it affects the precipitation patterns of particularly the southern tier of the United States. Here in California, the prediction is that we will see a wetter than normal winter in the north, a flip a coin we don't know in the central, and a drier than normal conditions in the south. The bullseye for the prediction for lower precipitation, Texas, which is already suffering badly from the drought that they're in. So this is not good news for the people living in Texas and also in South Florida. So I've given you the website, and literally every Monday they update it, and there's a suite of 38 slides that you can sort of click through. It has all these metrics and then has a very clear summary slide as to what the conditions are. And I just thought it's worthwhile to share, because we're increasingly using some of this information and this sort of midterm climate characteristics to help us with managing some of our water supplies.
The, related to that, I don't think it's yet been posted on the web, but it will be. There's a very smart retired engineer in Southern California who sent us a copy of the just-released U.S. Department of Defense study on climate change worldwide and defense-related and international security issues. And because it was just hot off the press, I thought it was interesting. It came out the same week as the fuss about the fact the Central Intelligence Agency does something comparable, but for security reasons, they won't release their report. And I was only able to read the executive summary of it. But it's interesting, as Cliff points out, if you think larger, you can almost start uneasily to see where problems are coming or will be avoided for a certain period of time. And this kind of wide study, research, evaluation, and dissemination over time is going to pay dividends. But it is pretty sobering, all things considered.
Okay. A couple of groups who actually use this information on a regular basis are commodity traders and insurance companies.
Sure. Good. Okay. All right. Questions of Cliff. Thank you very much. Appreciate that a great deal. Okay. Members, if you would turn to agenda item number 7. Agenda item number 7, Mr. Grindstaff.
Yes, and this will be really brief. We're in the process of negotiations with Peter Goodwin, as we all have talked about before, have not yet reached a conclusion. We hope to have that done by next meeting so we can bring the appointment of a new lead scientist to the council.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. All right, 4 minutes early, contrary to our first experience with Mr. Craig Wilson. Agenda item number 8, our Delta Water Master is here. And Mr. Wilson, where do you want to sit at the table? Probably that would be more sensible. And you may have some slides. I believe that's correct. Good to see you again.
They are in your packet, if you... Yep.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the council. I'm pleased to be here today to report on a program administered by the State Water Board entitled The Statements of Water Diversion and Use. I will keep my comments brief. I know you have a heavy agenda. Why this report? This statements program has been around for about 45 years and has been kind of on the back burner of anybody's attention. But it was amended substantially as part of the 2009 water reform legislation, and it was amended in ways to strengthen it and to make it much more relevant to the Delta. And in fact, it now provides a vehicle to provide much more certainty regarding water use in the Delta, certainty regarding how many people are diverting water in the Delta, how much water is being diverted in the Delta, and the validity of water rights in the Delta. And I think providing more certainty really gets to the heart of why the Delta Water Master position was created. When I was first appointed to this position a little over a year ago, I spent quite a bit of time talking to people about, you know, what do you feel the Water Master position is all about? What is its purpose? And you had some people saying, hey, we feel that there are significant illegal diversions in the Delta, and you ought to go root them out and free up water. And I heard other people saying, no, the water rights in the Delta are senior, they're inviolate, and to, you know, go out harassing those types of people will distract people's attention from things that are more important, such as adopting flow standards and considering flow matters. So after listening to a lot of people and talking about this and studying it, I think this whole idea of certainty, trying to get to the bottom of the things regarding how much water is being used, how many people are diverting, will answer some of these questions and get to the bottom of a lot of these things. And in fact, I think this whole issue of certainty is what differentiates the Delta Water Master from what I call the traditional Water Master, of which there have been many in the state of California. Traditional Water Masters are usually dealing with a very small area where either through court decree or adjudication or settlement, the water rights are extremely well defined. Everybody knows how much they're supposed to divert. They know how many diverters there are. And the Water Master is just sort of the person there deciding, you know, who uses the water. Everybody plays by the rule. Contrast the Delta situation, where I think the role is more to provide that type of certainty where it's not there now. So the question becomes, you know, how do we get to a place of more certainty? And that's where the Statements of Water Diversion and Use program comes into. So on to the slides. The statement program, in a nutshell, states that with minor exceptions, all persons that divert water from a surface water course and that do not have a permit or license from the board have to file a statement of water diversion of use with the State Water Resources Control Board. It's a statewide program, but it's become much more relevant to the Delta. And in going through these slides rather quickly, I'm going to cover four basic things: the relevance of the program to the Delta, history of the program, recent changes, and focusing on a new water measurement and requirement that will be coming into play next year. Regarding the relevance of the program to the Delta, the Delta Water Master's authority does extend to monitoring and reporting, but most Delta diverters, as we'll see, do not have board permits or licenses. So the state's program is really the primary reporting program for both monitoring of diversion and use in the Delta. Until recently, in-Delta diverters were not required to measure and report on their water use, and historically there has been little data regarding the nature, extent, and location of diversions. There have been a lot of older studies, but nothing more recent. And the statements program, as I alluded to before, I think has the main purpose and main ability to provide more certainty for water use in the Delta. Okay, a little bit about the history of the program. As I stated, it started over 45 years ago, and it stated at that time that all diverters were required, quotes unquote, to file statements, but it was a very illusory requirement because at the end of the sections dealing with it says that this is for informational purposes, and if persons do not file a statement, there's no legal consequence to the failure to file. So consequently, there were not a lot of statements filed. And on top of that, most Delta diversions were exempt from the statements program. So as of 2009, you only had about 250 statements from the statewide program regarding Delta diverters. It's important to note that the statements are not a water right. They're basically a record of diversion, and their purpose is really to provide a central repository for records of diversion and use. And there were some requirements that the reports of amounts be filed, but they were basically just estimates. There were no specific measurement requirements. So on to the recent changes in the program. Most of the exemptions from filing statements were eliminated, including those that were applicable to most Delta diversions. The requirement now is real. The section of the law that stated that there was no legal consequence for not filing was repealed, and in its place there are actually fines and penalties associated for not filing a statement. As a consequence to these changes in the law, in the last 2 years we've received almost 7,000 new statements statewide and over 2,000 from the Delta. Remember I said it up till 2009 there were only about 250 statements on board, so now we're way over that. And then lastly, specific measurement requirements were added, which I'll get to in a second. So what have we learned from these statements that have been filed in the last couple of years? I think generalizing, you could state that the total amount of statements and diversions on file, including board licenses and permits, is roughly 3,000 diversions in the Delta. About 90% of those diversions are not pursuant to board permit or licenses, but are based on other water rights, such as riparian water rights and what are called pre-1914 water rights. So for the first time, we're getting a more accurate picture on the number of diversions in the Delta. There's no accurate numbers yet on the amounts of water being used in the Delta, but that uncertainty will be addressed by these new water measurement requirements that are coming into play in January coming up this year. Basically, starting in January of 2012, all statement holders will be required to provide monthly records of water diversions. The law says that these measurements are to be based on best available engineering and best professional practices, unless the diverter can demonstrate that such practices are not locally cost effective. One thing I would like to point out, that this program, the Statement of Water Diversion Use Program, is separate and distinct from a different measurement program that you may have heard about that's administered by the Department of Water Resources that applies to large agricultural water users. They're in the process of, they have adopted emergency regs, and I believe they're just about ready to finalize those regulations. I think they're going before the Water Commission. They're dealing with large suppliers, but it does get to the point of measuring diversions at certain takeout points. But it's separate and distinct from this program, which basically deals with all diversions of water, regardless of the type and amount. Like I stated before, There are fines and penalties for not measuring pursuant to these new requirements, and so it's a program that will have some teeth to it. There were some findings regarding the purpose of these new requirements. I would just point out it called out the Delta as one of the main reasons for having these new water measurement requirements, and the legislature had findings that there has been little data on use and amounts, and that's one of the reasons to have these new requirements be put into place. The statutory program does have definitions regarding best available measuring technology, best professional practices. You can read the language. I think what it really points you toward is if you go into that best available technology, you're probably looking at devices such as meters. There is no definition of locally cost effective. So to summarize the new approach, monthly monitoring will be required starting this January. Monitoring devices based on best engineering practices are to be utilized unless the diverter can demonstrate that such measures are not cost effective. And at that point, there still is a measuring requirement. It would be followed by using some type of alternative monitoring method. I think the new law places a lot of responsibility on the individual diverters. They will have to measure. They'll have to figure out if they should you be using devices based on engineering technology, or whether they can make the demonstration to use an alternative monitoring method based on the fact that the cost of best engineering practices is not locally cost effective. The Water Board, to try to assist the diverters, did hold an informational workshop on July 21st of this year. We've received a lot of comments and reports from the public. Based on that review, the Water Board had decided to provide guidance to people that were subject to these new measurement programs, and that guidance was put out in draft form earlier this month, I believe. It had a narrative summary of the program, a draft of the revised statement program, which kind of walks people through the new requirements. It had information regarding examples of water measuring devices, examples of alternatives based on local cost-effective findings, vendors lists. At least one vendor hosted a workshop earlier this month to try to get people on board for some of the alternatives available. And so there was a lot of guidance attempted to be put out. Comments were asked to be provided to the State Water Board on this guidance by this Friday, the 18th of November. And I think just in short, to kind of what I've been saying to diverters who are kind of concerned about the uncertainties related to this new program is that, if they provide monthly records of the diversion, which will be required for the first time, even the measurement methods come into play January 1 of next year, but the first actual report comes in 2013. If they make a good faith effort to follow the guidance, come up with a measuring system, and provide that method and information to the board, I think they'll be in good shape. The board also may conduct further public meetings and discussions on this depending on the comments we get from the draft guidance, and also might consider fine-tuning of the statutory requirements themselves based on comments that might be received. So that's basically the monitoring program. I'll just conclude by maybe mention just a few other things that my office has been working on. As I indicated in my remarks, there are about 3,000 diversions in the Delta. We have a pretty small staff. We've been looking at some of the compliance and monitoring issues, and what I've concluded is that it may be more cost-effective and getting a bigger bang for the buck to look at some of the districts out in the Delta as opposed to 3,000 individual diversions. There are maybe 100, 150 special districts out in the Delta, everything from irrigation districts to reclamation districts. Some of them are in the water use and distribution business, and we've had a couple meetings with them, and it's been extremely beneficial to learn what they're doing. A lot of times they have a very good handle on water rights and water use in their district. We also can talk to them about the statements program, so I think we will continue to have those discussions more looking at districts as opposed to individual diversions. We have looked at some of the individual cases based on complaints. We've closed out a few cases recently. I did issue administrative civil liability complaint and settled one matter for a party that had not filed a statement. So we'll continue along that path. regarding future reports to your to this body and to the State Water Resources Control Board, I think my next one may be just kind of a summary of what we've done in the enforcement and compliance effort in dealing with the specific cases over the last year and a half or so, and that will probably be my next topic for discussion. So with that, I will close unless you have any questions.
Okay, Don?
Yep.
Then Randy.
Thank you, Craig. I just kind of curious because it's the practical application of what you've gone through and what you just mentioned in some of your closing comments that you said you, not getting the specifics of the particular matter, but that you settled one case with civil penalties. The idea here is to get compliance, to have the reporting, to have the statements filed. So what is the hammer, though, that you're, you know, that in, under the law you're utilizing? You know, it seemed to me that you know, people obviously may have a difference of opinion about whether they should have to do this and make their own judgments about whether they file or not. But I'm just curious about that. It's, you know, what you just said, that was just one situation. So out of many hundreds or a few thousand, that's probably a pretty good statistic. But I'm just kind of curious a little more about the practical terms.
Sure.
Obviously, you've done outreach. You have a limited staff that does that. You mail something to somebody. They can, you know, take it to heart or to ignore it either way. But I'm a little bit curious about that, again, as to how, you know, you're approaching that, I guess, from a practical standpoint.
Sure. Be glad to answer that. You know, when I came into this job, you know, I realized that a lot of new requirements were being placed on some of the Delta diverters, that the requirement to even file the statement of water diversion and use, and then these new measuring requirements that are come on board. So we did place a heavy emphasis on outreach. And I think it really paid off in the Delta. I'm not sure on the exact statistics, but I believe that the Delta, even though it was a new program to them, had a higher compliance rate in filing statements than many other areas of the state, because we did make a conscious effort. We held at least one or two workshops out in the Delta, had a lot of cooperation from some of the parties out there, and had a pretty good compliance rate on filing of the statements. We have not found any type of widespread failure to file statements of water diversion of use, even though this is a brand new program. The more troublesome one, because it's a lot more you know, potentially more expense and more work by the diverters, is complying with this new water measurement program. It's just coming on board now, but again, we're trying to engage in the outreach. We held the workshop in July. You know, I've gone out into the Delta and talked a lot of people about this, and I think this is where this district approach may help a lot, going out to an individual reclamation district or a flood control district or a mutual water company and having kind of this two-way conversation. Here's some of these new requirements. Here's how they work. And making sure people understand them, the district can help ensure compliance. On the same hand, we're getting a better handle on water rights issues, where there might be issues of compliance. So it's proven to be effective so far, and we will accelerate this effort of trying to work more on the district level, as opposed to just, you know, looking at these 3,000 statements with just a handful of staff and trying to go that route.
Just curious, in the written report, you went through some different methods. Everything you mentioned, metering, but there's ways to measure through energy usage, and I guess there was even some satellite approach that, again, I don't know what the expense is and, you know, how you track all that and break down certain components. But I mean, you provided at least a limited menu of some ways of doing this, kind of that best practices, and recognizing some of the costs that might be associated both with record keeping, but certainly in putting the equipment actually in place and then making sure that it's you know, operating, you know, as it should, so it gives you proper measurements and so forth. So calibrated, I guess, would be the word. So.
Yeah, what we tried to do is go through the legal requirements and just kind of almost a, you know, follow the bouncing ball kind of approach. That here, if you're looking at best engineering devices and technology, here are the various options available. But if you want to try to make this demonstration that the implementation of those is not locally cost effective, here are some alternative measures that can be used, and we listed several, and then gave you know, vendors lists and encouraged vendors to try to get the word out, and at least one vendor had a major workshop and informational session. So, you know, we're trying as best we can. I know there's still some confusion and concern by people out in the Delta about complying, but I think we've, you know, tried to do as best we could to get information out there.
Okay, just a couple of quick follow-ons. So when is it that you anticipate that, assuming you get some good data, say, I think it was next summer in June when they have to begin to actually have some of the measurement information. So is it a year from now you think you'll have some idea then as relative to the based upon measurements the amounts?
The first reports that will be required to be filed based on the new monitoring requirements will be in July of 2013.
Okay,
so that's when we'll start to get the data and be able to look at it.
So you're about 18 months out from from that information.
Yeah, they'll have to start the measurements, starting this January, but the actual reporting would be July of 2013.
One final question. What's your sense then from your work, your outreach, and what you know, having been in your role now for a good period of time, of how many of the pool of folks out there are now being have actually filed the statements? You got 95% compliance, 97% compliance, you got close to 100%, or what's your call on that?
I think it's probably at least 90% in the Delta from what I can see. It's a high compliance rate, and I think it's because a lot of hard work done by the staff of the State Water Resources Control Board and a lot of good work by people in the Delta getting the word out to people. So it is, I'm not saying all the statements were filed accurately, and we may have some issues with whether or not, some of the information's, totally what we need to have, as far as, maps to specify the exact place of use, the diversion point. But the actual filing of statements, so the compliance rate was quite high.
Okay, thanks.
Randy, then Gloria.
Craig, you may recall I was somewhat critical of your first report, so it's only fair that I compliment you on this report. I thought it was very well done. From my farming perspective, I thought it was very comprehensive, very easy to read and understand, and so I want to compliment you on that. I didn't see in the report a definition of the geography of the Delta. Are you using the same boundaries that we use when we refer to the Delta as the legal Delta?
Yes, the legal Delta is defined, I believe, in Water Code Section 12200 or something like that, and that's the definition that was used for regarding
but
the statements.
You do not include the Suisun Marsh as we were directed to for our planning purposes, right?
No, I have not.
Yeah.
Okay. One of the struggles that the Delta Protection Commission had when they were putting together the economic sustainability plan was getting their arms around agricultural activity in the Delta, because much of the reporting is done county by county, and they're having a hard time parsing out what was in the Delta and what's out of the Delta. The irrigation districts that I work with all do reporting, and they collect data on the crops that are grown in every given year, and then apply the amount of water that we use per parcel. When you go to the legislature and ask for adjustments to the Reporting Act, would it be worth asking them to add a crop reporting element to that so we could begin to get a handle on the acreage of the different types of crops that are grown and how much water is used in the production of each?
Yeah, that could be a worthwhile thing to talk about. The statements of water diversion and use is one of the biggest issues that kind of gives you an incomplete picture, is that you're reporting on how much water was diverted from the water course, and you're not really talking as much about, because the Delta is so unique, the way the water flows in and out and the tides, that you a lot of times the use is not as accurate as what is actually diverted out from the water course. So your idea is kind of a corollary to that, to get to the issue of exactly what the crops are using, and then you can get to the consumptive, how much is being consumed. You can estimate that a lot better if you know what crops are being grown out there. And the report and the statute does not require that now. So I'll write that down as a possibility for fine-tuning this legislation.
I think if I were a grower in the Delta, I would welcome that, because it would just eliminate the exposure for water misuse, because you'd now have the facts to back up the efficient use of water as it's applied. Is there going to be a compliance auditing process employed after the first couple of years, after you get things rolling?
I mean, obviously there's a compliance component to this, and what we're trying to do is to make it, get the biggest bang for the buck. I'm not a very computer savvy person, but I've been working with some of the people in our office to try to make sure that as these forms are converted into electronic format, the next round will be coming electronically, that we get our GIS overlays and various things where you can be able to actually search the database, go to the legal delta, be able to see exactly where these diversion points are, have the map show the place of use. And by doing that, I think it will enable us to, even with a fairly small staff, to hopefully at least get to some of the compliance issues, because the worst thing we want to do with just a handful of staff is just run around to each of these 3,000 diversions, because you're just not going to make very much headway. So it's got to be done smarter than that, and we're going to try to do so.
Final question. Do you need any help from the Stewardship Council or the Science Board?
Hey, you want to loan me about 10 staff? I'll take them. No.
We've been asking for the reverse of that.
Gloria.
And thank you very much for your comments and your proposal this morning. It's interesting that the type of documentation that this program is requiring now was never done before. At least for me, it's interesting to know that never happened. I was required before, but I know that you indicated that the documentation will become available next, 2013, July, but is there anything that you can come back and report to the council in between that time that could be helpful to the council, or is that your plans, what you plan to do?
No, I'm required by law to provide regular reports to both the Water Board and the Stewardship Council, and I can certainly give you updates, but sooner than July of 13 on some of these issues. Like I say, we now have a lot better information on the number of diversions, and we're in the process of entering all these 2,400 statements into a searchable database with a GIS type of smart map overlay, and I certainly could come back to this council and provide as specifics become available as we get more certainty, which that's my key word for the year, I think. It's just trying to get more certainty on these things, and as we get it, I certainly can come back before you and try to show you what we have.
Good. And it sounds like you're getting corporation out there. So do you have any idea, would it be every 4 months or the next 4 months or 6 months, do you think you'll have something significant?
I certainly plan on coming back before you guys at least two or three times a year on various topics. Like Randy mentioned, my first one, which got off to kind of an interesting start. But, I believe this is my third report, and it's been a little over a year. So I continue, that's one of the statutory obligations that the Water Master has, is to provide these types of reports.
Well, thank you very much for the report this morning.
Craig, I also want to compliment you on the report. I thought this was pretty clear. A couple of questions on the chart, which appears actually on page 7 of your written report, although it's not numbered in our binder. It's the actual 7th page. This is a summary of water rights in the legal delta. Down at the bottom, there's this little entry that puzzles me, and I don't know why it did, but you list stock ponds. The only category of water use that's listed separately, there must be a reason for listing it, and I puzzled about what it was.
Let's see. I think the idea was there is that it's a registration. I think it's called in the laws. It's a type of a water right, but it's kind of a
specialty category.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right,
exactly. And there are a lot of stock ponds that have water rights, and it's called a registration process. But as you can see, there are not very many in the delta. I toyed with taking that out because it does kind of, there's only three of them, and it kind of causes confusion.
But it went to Randy's question, really, of what's the water being used for in terms of crops or other activities, which is a useful thing. So can I make one suggestion, not on the information, but this chart or charts like it are likely to become in the future the regular articulation and reports that are supposed to be publicly understandable on the overall subject. And the subject of this activity, taken from your title, water diversions and use in the Delta. That's kind of the shorthand. Just a suggestion. I think you should ask some of your people to spend some time thinking about how to present the questions of total diversions and uses in a graphic format that's understandable outside the arena of the technicians who put the report together. It's a recurring problem in all governmental and technical problems. And so I look at it, and it seems to me just the total volume of use within the statutory delta, I always think, is the starting point. Randy's issue, which is the question of how the water is used, for what purposes, is kind of how I'd advance to the second state. The third thing then becomes the legal status of the use of water. And I'm not sure even that the way I've just described it to you is the right way, but I do know that 10 years from now, 15 years from now, a chart like this becomes what people will turn to try to figure out what's going on. And it is so important to think carefully about how it's formatted, not to add new requirements on information unless authorized by statute, but just explaining it publicly. So that would be worth some time, I think, because you could actually could set a standard that we could follow on that, and the Water Board and the Department of Water Resources and all the state agencies with understandable summaries of information they have. That would be really important.
That's a good comment. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions to Craig? Okay. Mr. Watermaster, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Mr. Grindstaff, we are now to file item number 9. And maybe you would like to kick this off, and I know that Gwen and David and Chris Stevens and you are doing all this.
I will be glad to kick it off. As you know, we released the draft programmatic environmental impact report on November the 4th and had a council meeting just before we released the report. We have set deadline for comments for January 3rd of this coming year.
Oh, thank you.
That's the day after the holiday, because January 1st comes on a Sunday, so people get Monday off typically the 2nd, so it comes the very next day. We have received, since we released the EIR, I think it's 16 requests for extensions from a broad variety of people. The requests range from requesting 15 days to, I guess, 120 days, additional days for 180 days total. Most of them are in writing, and as I say, it's a broad variety of people from the environmental community, the water community, and folks in the Delta, so there's no... No, everybody wants more time. So, and at the last meeting, we also talked about scheduling some tentative field hearings, and we have some tentative field hearings, but we didn't want to schedule those until we came back to this council and talked with you about that. I can tell you what dates we were talking about. We were talking about the week of December the 5th in Chico, Turlock and Merced, Pasadena, and then on December the 13th in San Diego. If, however, you take action to extend the comment period, it might be wise to delay those field hearings until January. So those are issues. That's kind of my summary. Those are the key issues that are open that I think we need to talk about here. And I... Gwen or Chris?
Can I make a suggestion? I think we ought to start with the entire process. We're going to wind up with a discussion of, do we want to extend the time? I know that when I had to leave the meeting for the memorial service last time, we were headed to that discussion. I read the minutes and the report. But that's not, that's the final stage. I think we need some context, overall report first on the Delta Plan EIR. And then let's end up in our discussion with the timing, if you don't mind. Okay. All right.
Okay. Yeah, that
Mr.
sounds
Stevens.
Great. Thank you. From a real broad overview perspective, what we're going to to present to you with Gwen and David running through a few slides is an update on the EIR process. As Joe said, we released a draft programmatic environmental impact report on November 4th. That's circulated now for public review and comment. And as we know, there's a 60-day comment period beginning on that date and ending on January 3rd. Gwen and David are going to run through some of the logistics of where we're at and the update on that. Before they get there, I just want to give you brief context on what the document is and what the document is not, because I think it's important to keep that in perspective right now. And also it ties into what Joe was alluding to, the issues that we think are still open issues that you had asked us to come back to and talk to you about at this meeting. And those issues are, in effect, our request to you to give us direction as staff to perhaps extend the comment period or to add hearing dates. But that ties into what this document actually is. And this document is a draft document. It's a draft environmental impact report, and I highlight the word draft. At this point, we have now entered into a legal process. The EIR is required under the body of law called CEQA. It's actually required for this type of legally enforceable Delta plan, and that's why we did it. So that's first. Second, we are in a legal process now. It's a process that's set out in statute and in regulation and is subject to a whole body of case law.
Do I have to wear a tie at every meeting?
You don't.
Now on?
You don't, but
okay.
You look good for this initial one, yes. The legal process is important, and it's recognized by CEQA practitioners, stakeholders, bureaucrats that do this all the time. A draft EIR is floated in an attempt to elicit comments from the public to refine the document. So the public will comment, and this is going to actually segue into a period that we're going to have after lunch from 1 o'clock to 4:30. It'll be an oral testimony opportunity for people to come on the record and provide public comment. But in any event, public comment during a public comment period, whether written or oral, has to be responded to in what's called a final EIR. The final EIR at that point will come back to this body, and there will be a presentation by staff as to what the document is. It should be a document that has been refined based upon comments, like I said. And at that point, we will come to you and ask for you to take ownership of that document. At this point, we're not asking you to take, this is a staff draft. This is the initiation of the EIR process. But when we come to you with a final document, we will say, okay, now under the law, you have to what's called certify the document, certify the final EIR, which means that in your independent judgment, obviously with our help and advice, you think that that document complies with CEQA, and it provides the informative tool that CEQA intends it to be. And again, it's going to be a tool. It's a tool that you will take ownership of, you will certify at that time, and then it will inform your ultimate decision on adopting a Delta plan. So that's the process. What we've done at a staff level now is put out a draft. It's a monster document. As you know, it's over 2,200 pages. But it, again, is the initial part of the process. We will hear from the public comments. There will be substantive comments, hopefully focused on the environmental assessment that's contained within the body of the draft EIR. And then we will provide comments as part of the final EIR, and then we will ask you to take ownership through certifying that, obviously within your discretion. If at that time you decide that the final EIR does not provide you the information that you think you need to adopt the Delta plan, you can ask for changes. You can decide you're not going to certify the EIR. It's wholly within your discretion, but that comes later in the process. I bring that up now because we are in the midst of a legal process with the draft EIR. So engaging at this point on the substance of the EIR as a public body
is frowned upon by legal guys like me because what you say will be on the record, will be a part of an administrative record, and what we are intending to do now is allow the public to come in and provide comments to help us as staff to make this a better document for you eventually to certify. So that's kind of a general, there's obviously a tension between transparency, public bodies, but again, we are now in a legal process having circulated this draft EIR. After Gwen and David give their brief update, what I would recommend is when you open up for public comment on this agenda item that you ask members of the public to focus in on the logistical two issues that Joe outlined originally, one being whether or not the board should direct staff to extend the comment period, which I think is entirely appropriate. Obviously, you asked for that at your last meeting. We've got a whole host of letters. We can talk about the range of days. And the other, if and when we should hold hearings, bifurcated type hearings where we would have the first half of the hearings focusing in on the Delta plan, the substance of the Delta plan. The second half perhaps being like the afternoon session here where we would have a court reporter, members of the public from up and down the state would have an opportunity to present oral comments on the record. So that's what we would attempt to focus public comment on this agenda item. If any members of the public have comments specifically that go to the substance of the EIR, we would respectfully ask that they stick around until 1 o'clock, and we will actually have a court reporter sitting here to transcribe their comments, which will be responded to in the final EIR.
Okay.
So with that, I will turn it over to Gwen and David.
We'll get the presentation loaded. Good morning.
Morning.
Last time we were before you was last October. The document had not come out yet. And Jim Andrew provided a presentation that outlined some of the unique characteristics of this document and also the approach that was taken. So what we'll do today is, we'll, as Chris mentioned, we'll go through quickly, talk about the noticing process that went on with the release of the document, and then briefly touch on what Jim had discussed in actually drawing on some of the slides that he presented last time. I think that now that people have started to take a look at the document, there may be some value in hearing some of that again, just to provide some context. I suspect that most everyone now has a copy of this or has access to it, but it is available in multiple sources. The easiest probably is on the council website, and people can go there and download the document directly there. It's also available in the main county libraries in each of the counties that is in the study area. So someone that doesn't have access could go to the libraries and take a look at the document there. And then finally, if anybody wants a CD-ROM, that will be made available, and it's available just by requesting that from the council, and they can do that either online or via phone. The notice of availability, which is really the notice that the document is available for public review, went out the week that the document was released. Went to over 1,250 recipients. Went to every county, incorporated city, and council of government within the study area. It also went to many of the special districts, schools, and so forth in the Delta and in the immediate surrounding area. And in addition, it also went to every member who or participant in scoping meetings that actually signed in. So that they got
those are the previous council scoping meetings, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
In addition, the notice went to relevant state and federal agencies, regional agencies, locals as well, state and federal water contractors, and Native American Indian tribes, again, within the study area. Because of the statewide importance, this was noticed fairly broadly in the newspapers. It went into 18 newspapers in total, ranging from San Diego up through Reading. So I think we got pretty good coverage within the study area on the noticing within the newspapers. As I mentioned, there was a presentation given by Jim at the last meeting on the approach, and these several next slides will be very similar to what you had heard previously, and I'll move through them fairly quickly. In general, the EIR covers many various issues. There are 19 resource areas that were analyzed and 280 or so actual impact determinations for specific impacts. And just as a reminder, the proposed project that's evaluated by the EIR is the fifth staff draft of the Delta Plan. The council, part of the interesting part of this is that the council is not going to directly construct projects to further the co-equal goals. Instead, you exert influence through the Delta Plan, through the policies and recommendations that encourage others to take actions that will actually help to achieve the co-equal goals. And that provides a little bit uncertainty about, you know, what exactly is going to happen. So for the purposes of the EIR, what was done was to assume that the Delta Plan was going to be successful. In other words, that the actions that were encouraged by the Delta Plan would actually be undertaken. And so our evaluation was based on anticipating the kinds of projects, the kinds of programs that would come from those policies and recommendations, and then doing a programmatic level analysis on those particular impacts. The way that those impacts or those kinds of projects were organized was based on the structure of the Delta Plan itself. So for each of the five categories that were in the Delta Plan, the reliable water supply, ecosystem restoration, water quality, and so forth, all the kinds of projects that we anticipated that could occur were evaluated for each of those categories. We also took a look at some of the projects that were named specifically in the Delta Plan. So the Delta Plan has recommendations and policies that indicate or encourage a specific project. In those cases, then, what we did is we took a look at that and analyzed those on a programmatic level as well. One of the I wouldn't say challenges, but one of the interesting aspects of this is that we have an evaluation of these actions that we're anticipating that could occur. And so what we did is we took a look at, you know, for example, under water supply reliability, we're anticipating that there could be many kinds of projects that might facilitate that, surface water storage, treatment facilities, intakes, pipelines, and so forth. And so we evaluated those on a general level based on the experience of the folks that were doing the evaluations, those that were the experts in those particular areas. But we felt like we needed to provide some additional context as well. And so to add to that analysis, what we did was take a look at other recently completed environmental documents that evaluated similar kinds of projects and use that information to help provide, as I mentioned, a little context for what was going on in the document. For example, the Davis Woodland Water Supply Project was one of the documents that we took a look at, and it includes features such as intakes, pipelines, treatment plants, and so forth that are probably similar to, although not identical, but similar to the kinds of things that would be anticipated under the Delta Plan. And so we drew from those kinds of sources to further the analysis in the document. Because there is uncertainty about specifically what's going to happen, the EIR takes a fairly conservative approach in its determinations. If, for example, we had reason to believe that an impact would be significant, we called it significant. For the example here that we're showing, a noise impact, if we had reason to believe that construction could occur over a 24-hour period, or we had an example EIR that we looked at that showed that that impact could occur over a 24-hour period, we assumed that the kinds of impacts that would occur from projects under the Delta Plan would be that way. So again, that's a very conservative approach. A further thing too that we dealt with is that, the reason that we took the conservative approach is that the council really can't guarantee that mitigation will occur for those that are non-covered actions. And so to be conservative, many of these impacts are called significant as well. There were several alternatives that were evaluated, five in all, including the no project alternative. The four action alternatives contain, for the most part, similar activities that as the proposed project, with different levels of emphasis placed on each of those five categories. They looked at different levels of export, looked at different levels of flood risk, different levels of ecosystem restoration, as an example. And all of these are described in greater detail in Section 2A of the document. The alternatives analysis included really an assessment of the alternatives at a similar level that we assess the proposed project. All alternatives, including and the proposed project, were evaluated against existing conditions. So the significance of the impacts were determined relative to existing conditions. In addition, the alternatives were also compared to the proposed project to give you a sense of how those alternatives performed relative to the proposed project and whether the impacts were greater or less than you would anticipate from the proposed project. Another note is that the Delta Plan took a look at mostly construction impacts, or many of the impacts were construction-related impacts, which are short-term. There were some longer-term impacts. But what we wanted to do, too, is make sure that we provided a meaningful analysis. And so in the analysis, you'll see that for those alternatives that do less than the proposed Delta Plan in addressing the ongoing trend, downward trend on ecosystem and flood risk, that was determined to be an impact. And so those alternatives were determined to have greater impacts than the proposed project. Finally, and I think you've touched on some of this already, but is how to comment on the environmental document. There are a number of ways to do that as well. Email through the council's website or directly through the address EIRcomments at deltacouncil.ca.gov. There is a comment box on the council website that people can use as well to submit their comments. And then the public meetings where oral testimony will be taken, the first one obviously today, and the next on December 15th. And currently the close is on January 3rd, but we'll see where things go and adjust accordingly. So with that concludes our update. And
okay.
Go from there.
Chris.
Yeah, I just wanted to touch upon a couple of the things that aren't required by CEQA, but that you have asked staff to incorporate into this process, because I think it's important that we reiterate that we've gone over and beyond what the law actually requires, and now we may consider even extending the comment period further. But, at 1 o'clock, we're going to have the first of our oral testimony opportunities before a court reporter, which we've hired, who will be in here from 1 to 4:30, I believe. That's not required by CEQA. Providing an opportunity for oral comment, not required, but we've got at least two of them scheduled. The next one would be in December. So that, an approach that we've taken in the CEQA assessment and analysis was studying the alternatives at the same level as the proposed project. That wasn't and isn't required by CEQA, but we did that going beyond what was required. The other thing has to do with what we as staff are going to ask for some deliberation now on the public comment period. I think Joe alluded to the fact, and we talked about it last meeting, that for projects like this, there's a minimum 45-day public comment period
The guidelines go on to say that it should be no longer than 60 days, except in unusual.
I'm sorry, guidelines.
The CEQA guidelines. Oh. So those are, in effect, regulations, CEQA regulations. Shouldn't go longer than 60 days, except in unusual circumstances. You'll probably hear from a whole bunch of stakeholders and interested persons that have, if they don't present here, they have sent in letters that you've probably reviewed pointing out what they think are unusual circumstances. But again, to keep this in perspective, projects as big as the high-speed rail project had a 60-day comment period. So in any event, we are taking the idea of going over and beyond what's in the law seriously, the idea of transparency seriously, and with that, I'd turn it over to Joe, I guess, to engage on those two issues or send it back to you.
Okay. Mr. Grindstaff.
I got ahead of the plan, obviously, but I'll say it again. We've received a number of requests for extension. We have identified tentative sites for field hearings, which you requested we do at the last meeting. I think understanding what the extension date is will inform the judgment that we should then
make precise dates of the field hearings.
Yeah. And with that, I guess the one other point I should make is as we extend these, there is an obvious impact on the ultimate schedule. So if we extend the comment period on the EIR, I just want you to know, not that I'm opposed to it, but that it will have an impact on the end date when it's possible to responsibly adopt a Delta plan.
Okay. Before I go to public testimony on this, Chris, I want to make sure I understand correctly. The public testimony on this item is related not to the content of the environmental impact report, but to this procedural stuff we've been talking about, right? Correct me if I'm stating
that's
it incorrect.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Number two, is it therefore clear that the previous statements of parties who testified at the last meeting on time deadlines and that was reflected in the minutes, that we can take account of those statements?
Yeah, we take account of all statements.
Okay. Letters that have been received in the interim.
But there's a difference, and I think we should distinguish. We actually got a couple comments or questions from stakeholders as to previously submitted comments on the draft Delta plan and whether or not those stood and constituted comments on the EIR. And I think it's important to be clear now that we have a public comment period on the EIR. The comments should be on the environmental assessment contained in the EIR. And if, as I said, we have to respond to those comments, it's now a formal legal process. So if stakeholders want to comment on the EIR, they have to comment on the EIR. And again, there are a whole host of opportunities to do that. You can do it in writing, you can do it orally, you can do it through our website, I believe. But those are separate processes, the Delta planning process, the EIR process. Again, the EIR ultimately will be a tool that will help to inform your decisions on the environmental impacts of whatever decision you make.
Joe.
Yeah, maybe I should explain the process so that it's clearer to everyone. What we're anticipating is that upon closing of the comment period on the EIR, that staff will compile and try and bring together all of the comments in a summary way and prepare materials for council meetings. And as you may recall, we looked at having 4 days of meetings in February, March, and April. So we thought by the end and in March and in April, yes. So we expected that we would come back. We would have all of the comments that people have made on the fifth draft, which I think approach 1,000 comments, probably more than 1,000 comments on just the fifth draft.
then all of the comments on the EIR, because those may be related, and we'll come back and go through those. We will also probably need to go through the economic sustainability plan and say, okay, here are the recommendations from the Delta Protection Commission, and go through what those comments are. We will make staff recommendations and point out to you issues that are big and small for direction from the council. After we get that direction, we will prepare a sixth draft Delta plan and bring that back to the council and give everyone opportunity for comment on that, and then get final direction. And with that final direction, we'll prepare a seventh draft. And while we're working on this in parallel, we'll be working on the EIR and the response to comments. And we'll bring back the EIR, bring that to the council. You will certify the EIR, and after certification of the EIR, then can make the decision to adopt the Delta plan. So it's an evolved process.
I predict with a relatively high level of certainty that these crystal clear categories we're describing may become muddled as testimony goes on and hearings are conducted.
I'm sure.
So, Mr. Stevens, I want you on high alert. It seems to me that what you're suggesting to us is that the process of addressing the environmental impact report, it is a discrete but related to the Delta plan process required by law, and it's important that we request that comments be directed to the environmental impact report itself, and that's what this process is fundamentally about until we close the comment period, accumulate the comments, and get the staff and consultant reactions, observations, and so on.
That's entirely accurate. I think that, again, the draft is a staff draft of the EIR, and we will be getting comments from the public to help us as staff prepare a final EIR, which then you can take ownership of, certify, as Joe talked about, before you adopt your Delta plan.
Right.
So we're not there yet. Whether or not things get muddled or not, I predict that we will follow the law as we always do, right, Mr. Chair?
Got it. Okay.
Can I add something?
Yes.
I believe that Mr. Stevens, who has been, I'm just impressed with your explanation of CEQA and our behavior as hearing officers and what we need to, that's just really good. Do you teach this? You should teach.
Thank you very much. Not only do I not teach, but I don't know anything about CEQA, so I guess that's a real compliment. Thank you.
That's a testimony to Jim over there.
Okay.
I believe he also advised us, if we're going to go into romp room, to use our listening ears and shut our talking mouths in the hearing process, because we're acting as hearing officers. The emphasis is on hearing.
That's right. And again, you know, the hearings are not required. Thank you, Felicia. The hearings aren't required. We have one scheduled from 1 to 4:30 today. Again, board members are invited to stay to listen if they want to get a context of what the public comments are so far. Keep in mind that the draft is large, voluminous. We're only through, you know, mid-November. The draft came out on the 4th. So I'm sure all the comments will be positive and laudatory about the good work that we've done. But I suppose there could be some that suggest that they don't have enough time.
Hope springs
yet.
Eternal.
That's right. So in any event.
Don.
Yeah, just a question for you, Chris. This draft is based upon the fifth draft, the Delta plan. How is it that you decipher, though, as we're taking comments, certainly on the environmental document, basically, we've had comments on the fifth draft, and as Joe's outlined today and previously, then we'll have sixth draft, seventh draft, and what lies beyond, I don't know. But how do you decipher those things? Again, and I think going back to Felicia's comment and what you've advised relative to the listening and the public comment periods in the legal process, but in essence, you're still taking comments on fifth draft for preparation of a sixth draft, that the environmental document will have to then back that up as we go along. So could you just take maybe a moment just to kind of help sort that out, certainly from perspective of the council as in our respective role, but also so that those folks that will be commenting both in the legal process but also in the process we've been utilizing now for, you know, better part of a year relative to the drafts and iterations of white papers and of the draft plan itself. So,
well, yeah, and I appreciate the comment and the way that it was phrased, because I think that you distinguish between the two processes, which is important to keep in mind. The Delta planning process, we're obviously looking at a fifth staff draft, and most of the comments that we received have been on the substance and the policy, on whether or not we got it right, whether or not they should be refined, deleted, whatever it is, more exemptions, policy related. The environmental process is focused in on taking a snapshot of what the fifth staff draft is, the very few binding regulatory policies and the many more recommendations, but looking at that suite and looking at what the environmental impacts would be of those actions. So it's a different assessment, two different processes, but ultimately you're going to be adopting a Delta plan. And so the idea that the environmental process is going to be used as a tool to help inform your decision is one that I think we should keep in mind. So while people are commenting on the substance, the policy substance of the fifth staff draft, we'll also be getting comments on the draft EIR. And as Joe said, the challenge for staff then will be to have to go back, make heads or tails of comments on both processes, and then try to present to you suggestions on what we've heard through the various comment periods, and make suggestions as to whether we think you might consider changing the fifth staff draft. So I wouldn't necessarily talk about sixth and seventh drafts so much. At least in my mind, it's more ultimately you're going to be adopting a plan, and you've got different processes that are going to help inform what you ultimately get to. You haven't made any decisions yet. You will be asked to make a decision to certify the EIR and adopt a plan come spring. So that's...
Okay, I appreciate it. Just one other question then, and it goes to something that Joe summarized a moment ago, and that is that with the forwarding of the economic sustainability plan, and once it's completed with the peer review, and then depending upon what we do with this period of time relative to the environmental comment period, will you be looking at that from that lens as well relative to coverage as it relates to, and certainly a lot of the areas were covered in some of the alternatives, but nonetheless now you have very specific information, and this council obviously will have to take that up and consider that for inclusion or not, in part or in whole. And so I guess I'm just curious about how that integrates with the environmental comment period, since that plan didn't have a separate environmental process attached to it. So
that's right, and again, that's another process that we've committed to. I guess Joe said in January we would be taking a look at the recommendations contained in that plan. But it's the same issue with regard to any changes that we as staff suggest to you, or that you ultimately decide to make in the fifth staff draft, turning it into a sixth draft. We would have to make an assessment as to whether or not there is coverage under the CEQA document that we've done. And at that point, then we would advise you hopefully there will be. Hopefully it was done in a comprehensive, again, this is a programmatic document that's very, very general. Hopefully there will be coverage. But if there was an issue that arose where there wasn't coverage, we would talk to you about what the options were if you decided to include it. And one of those obviously would potentially be recirculating at least a portion of the EIR, and that would add time to your schedule. But we're not there yet, and so with the assessment of the economic sustainability plan, we may run into that issue. I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you. Just one final question, Mr. Chair. You've drawn the analogy, at least with regards to the I guess, kind of the bulk of the volume of information to the High-Speed Rail Authority. Was that a programmatic EIR or was that a project EIR?
I believe it was project, but I'm...
Oh, okay. Well, the reason I
get... It was.
We'll get you an answer at one
I have it from informed sources that it was.
Oh, it was a project. Okay. Well, and again, not that it makes it any less or more. I just, again, that may distinguish relative to some of the requests we've gotten for comments. So, okay, thanks.
All right. Any other things from the council? Okay. Now, Chris... Since I'm in my super sensitive position right now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get testimony from the audience. If you have previously spoken on the, particularly on the issue of a time extension or the duration of the comment period, or have written a letter, please note that all the council members are aware of that. Mr. Grindstaff mentioned it, so you don't have to start from scratch all over again. Randy?
Before that happens, I think it would be appropriate to ask staff for their recommendation. That was we left the last meeting with a request for a staff recommendation on the comment period time, whether it stay the same or be extended, and the field hearings and how many and where. Joe touched on it earlier briefly on the field hearings, but I'm a little confused, and so I think. And at least I need more clarification on what is the staff recommendation. I think that'll help the audience
on
to
field
respond.
Hearings right now. Field and hearings. Then secondly, the schedule.
Those both of those
okay,
issues.
Right.
Joe.
Okay. My recommendation is that we do have field hearings. That we do go with the four sites that we've talked about: two in Southern California, one in the Central Valley, and one. To the north, that's in addition to the two that the council's already agreed to. In terms of an extension of time, I do believe that extending the time by... I haven't wanted to give a time. I'll say 15 days is a reasonable time. One of the things...
Is that your final answer?
Sorry. That is my final answer. It probably pushes adoption of the plan into April, but on the other hand, with a deadline that comes in on the 3rd of January, I mean, just before the meeting, I had a call from someone saying, is the council going to delay this, or do I have to work over Christmas?
Was that your wife who called?
It was not my wife. It was not my wife. But it does seem to me that giving people... a couple extra weeks is useful. To be honest, having had staff review EIRs before, giving people another 3 or 4 months probably just means that they wait till the last month to start looking at the document before they start writing their comments. So I'm not sure that that provides any benefit, but actually giving them an extension into the middle of January I think is reasonable.
Gloria.
Joe, is that kind of the feeling of most of the folks who have written in for an extension?
Most of the folks who have written in. Here, I'll read to you what their days were. 90 days, 60 days, 60 days, 60 days, 120 days, 60 days, 60 days, 60 days, 60 days, 90 days, 90 days, 15 days, 30 to 60 days, 15 days, and two that just said... additional time, but no specific number of days. So it's all over the map.
So 60 was kind of the average, so you're extending it another couple of weeks.
In my professional
75
judgment,
days.
If you ask my professional judgment, 60 days is
But 75
necessary.
Days.
Yeah, let's clarify what we're talking about. The report was issued on November 4, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And we agreed at that time that there would be a minimum, 60. It would be 60-day comments, okay? The law requires, CEQA requires 45 days. We granted 60 days. CEQA, Chris, correct me on this characterization, says regulations in CEQA say that the comment period should close after 60 days unless there are, what's the phrase, extraordinary?
Unusual circumstances.
Or, I'm sorry.
Unusual.
Unusual circumstances. Okay, so you got to find unusual circumstances. And the requests of some of the people, when I read the letters, that wasn't clear. I just assumed that everybody takes 60 days for granted and piles everything else on top of it. And I read some of the letters at 200 days for a comment period, although I may be wrong. And so we're talking about November 4 as the start date. With the action we've previously taken, given 60 days, that's the starting point, right? Okay. All right, Don.
Well, can I finish my comment?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Yeah.
My question was that extension of 15 days on top of the 60 days, so that would be 75 days. That was a clarification I needed.
Yes.
And then you're suggesting other locations in parts of the state, and you'll come back with
these are the field hearings, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. If you agree to the extension for 15 days, then I would recommend going with the dates that I talked about, and I'll come back with more specifics, and we'll get venues put in place. That was in the first and second week of December.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Then Don.
Yeah. And again, I know we're going to hear from folks. I think Randy kind of jumped right to the recommendation, though, and I guess I would just say, as we're going to hear from folks, but there's the legal process, and I think Chris has been very well in defining that. We understand what the law says and unusual circumstances. I think the fact that you got 2,200 pages of documentation, much of that in appendices, that in itself is not the usual. You can have several hundred pages, but the size of the document, the volume of that. And I guess I would just go to the practical, and I think we're going to take that into consideration when we hear the comments. But 15 days, you still have the holiday season in there, and the fact that people are all working very hard to get this document out. But the legal aspects, I mean, this is what we've told people all along. As we've taken the thousands of comments on drafts and many comments that we're going to receive on this, and I'll just say that, as I said at the last meeting, and we're going to obviously come to some decision point today on this, but that, you know, I don't think it's unreasonable at all to add 30 or 60 days onto the process, not to add it on so that people wait to, you know, procrastinate to the last minute to respond. I just think that because of the magnitude of what we're considering here, the importance of it from many different perspectives, and going back to certainly the legal process, but the practical aspects of that as well, I think it's very important to give people a chance to digest it, to make their comments, because this is what we've told people all along. This is where you can, you know, pin your concerns, whatever they might be, and then we'll have that back for the Delta plan. But I recognize there may be differences about the number of days, but in my view, this is important enough that having that extra time, taking extra time and doing it right is going to be important.
Okay.
Can I give a follow-up?
Oh, I'm sorry, Ms.
Yeah.
Gray.
Yeah. I'm glad that Don made those comments, and that was kind of the comments that I think were made at the last meeting. I agree. I think it's important to give folks an opportunity to really respond. So, and it's an important document, so I certainly support extending it. I think I had suggested another 30 days, 90 days at the time that at the last meeting.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get testimony from the audience, please. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would come forward, indicate if you're speaking for anyone other than yourself personally, who that would be. And I guess we got some forms. And if you could fill out the forms, that would be appreciated. Mr. Koutras was first. Mr. Koutras, for the Delta County Coalition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the council. Appreciate the opportunity. I want to clarify our request, which we put on the record last meeting. We are seeking a total public comment period of either 90 or 120 days to extend the comment deadline to the first Monday in February, which would be February 6th, or the first Monday in March, which would be March 5th. We base this request on four primary factors, so you understand it. One is, frankly, the unique and unusual length of this document, and that it's a programmatic EIR, draft EIR. We have heard repeatedly at these public meetings, your staff and your council describe this as a highly complex, never done one before type of document. You heard Mr. Stevens this morning refer to it as a monster document. Frankly, we're trying to digest this monster document, and The second issue for us is we don't have the resources that this council has had to prepare the document. Counties are stretched very thin, as you well know. It's a sad story. I'm sure you've heard it before and years ago. But we continue to be stretched. And this is, the fourth reason, is a 100-year horizon. This is historic. And if that isn't unusual enough, programmatic, 100-year horizon, in the complexity of it, I don't know what is. I do think you have a basis to make a finding that a longer comment period beyond the 60 days is called for. So again, we're seeking a total comment period of either 90 days or 120 days.
Okay.
Last point on the field hearings, we think those are an excellent idea. And I wanted to clarify a comment I made last meeting, and it's reflected in the minutes of a roadshow. The concept we were trying to advance there, and so just I'll put it on the record here, it's not necessarily for decision this morning, but once you have completed your EIR and are prepared to certify it, once you have completed your final Delta plan and you're prepared to adopt it, that's where we're suggesting potentially you spend an extra couple of weeks and actually go out on the road and say, we're all done, folks. Here's our findings. Here's the EIR we're ready to adopt, and we're ready to go. Just in terms, for lack of a better, in terms of educating this state on what we're about to embark upon. So that's what we were trying to put on the record last time. I will not make, following the rules here this morning, not make any comments on the EIR nor the fifth staff draft, which, of course, you know we have issues with. But thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kutras. Okay, who's next? Kingsbury for the Mountain Counties.
Thank you very much. I'll make this brief. I do support the council members' opinion to extend this 60 days to 90 days. We do have a lot of members that, you know, the holidays are coming up, but more importantly, they don't have time to do this. I mean, the staff is very busy, and I do have members that have requested an additional 120 days, and we would appreciate any additional time that you could give us to this because it is an extraordinary document. 2,200 pages is, what, five reams of paper is this big, and it's going to take a while to go through and properly respond. So we would request an extension of time. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Baker from Restore to the Delta.
Yes, I'll be brief as well. I just wanted to come up and say that we, too, support the extension of the timeline to, I mean, the comment period to 120 days of March 6th. So. Can't imagine any other project. If this project doesn't qualify as extraordinary, I couldn't imagine what would. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, anyone else like to talk to us on this issue? Okay, discussion.
What's the process to make a motion regarding the extension, or how do you do this?
We'll do it. We'll either take a motion now, or we'll have, you know, just get the discussion from the council, whatever you want.
I guess reiterate, since we've heard the public comment, that I think that having this open till whether it's March 5th or 6th, the additional 60 days that would allow the opportunity, because other work will be going on. We're not going to be certainly idling while waiting for these comments to come in. And I think in recording them and drafting responses as they come in, that's all work that is be ongoing. I would support the more time rather than less time. So I would support the 60 days. And I would just say, secondly, I just want to speak to the field hearings, and I appreciate the. Again, I think it goes to the geographical vastness of this state, the vastness of what this plan touches upon, even though it may not encompass all the aspects, and going throughout the state. I would just suggest that as a part of our field hearings, whether it's this council in session or not, that we actually have one of those field hearings actually in the Delta. I know we meet in the legal Delta in West Sacramento. Mm-hmm. I would suggest that we go down into the Delta, right, and have one of our field hearings there as well, and, you know, it can be anywhere there. And again, Sacramento provides a good access for folks to travel less geographical distance to come and make comments on the plan, and a lot of that will be done electronically, I understand. But I think it's important, again, because this is the draft EIR on the Delta plan. I think we ought to have one of those hearings in the Delta, and not to take away from any of the other four sites that have been suggested, but maybe we could accommodate with one of our meetings in the next couple of months. Thanks.
Felicia.
Yeah, two different things. One is I just really like the field hearing idea, and I would agree with Don that we should do one further south in the Delta than Sacramento, in addition to somewhere even further south in the Central Valley as we do them. I'm torn here. I was kind of tough on it last time because I do think there's some element to folks having to book the time and sit down and focus. And if you extend it too long, people just do that later in the process. But I agree with Joe on that principle. On the other hand, I just think the holidays is a really awful time to have to do a term paper. And I think given that it is very complex, and of course, I think the fact that our schedule has slipped is unfortunate in a scheduling standpoint, but good in terms of us doing a really good quality job on this with people understanding it. So I think I'm more inclined to add 30 days so that people can have January, they have February, December to understand it, maybe January to write it down and do the hearings. And you might want to do some hearing. I wouldn't do all of the hearings in December. You might leave some till early January to do. So that's sort of my inclination. I'm less inclined to move it all the way to March. That's just, I just feel like we're, we're going to be past our statutory deadline. Again, it was not necessarily a realistic one given the other plans that need to be incorporated, but I'm also mindful of the need to sort of go as deliberately as we need to, but also as not more deliberatively than we need to. So at this moment, I'm inclined to support the 30-day extension from the 60 days, but not the longer one, just so that my colleagues know where I am at the moment.
Randy.
I would agree with Felicia, and I think most of the comments that we've received line up along the 30-day extension to a 90-day total. I think that's adequate.
I'd go along with that, although I'm not unhappy with the current 60 days, and because I think 2 months is enough time to do it. I look around the room, and if there's a person here who has not been here before, I do not see them. We are a family, and we have been doing this for 17 months, and the issues remain as controversial as they were the day we started, and it surprises none of the regular participants, all of whom are in this room, including those of us sitting at the table. Mm-hmm. So as far as I would go is a maximum length of 90 days, but I want to ask you a question, Joe. Does that mean we can then complete the process in your judgment and vote on the Delta plan, whatever it's going to be, mm-hmm. And the related environmental impact report in April? Because we have a statutory deadline, which we're going to miss, and I'm not enthusiastic about missing it by much more time.
I'm willing to commit to early May. I'm leery because of the volume of comments that we're likely to receive to say absolutely we can do it at the end of April. So mm-hmm. just it depend if everything goes perfectly, then yes, we can do it at the end of April. My experience in this process is it's a difficult one, and it may not all go perfectly. So,
Gloria.
Yeah, I come in. I know most of my colleagues have suggested or agreed or said they would support the extension of 60 more days. But I'd like to leave the option open, and I think it is.
It's 90 days in total.
Right, I understand. Yeah. 30 more days, 90 days in total, right. But I am concerned about the fact that Don has certainly expressed the need to leave it open. I know that there's a deadline and there's all kinds of things that Joe and staff have to deal with. But again, I think it's important to make sure that we have actually give opportunities for everyone to respond. And certainly 90 days total is a long time. But I think the holidays certainly will interfere with that. So I still would like to leave it open. I think it would be open because the council can make a decision at any time. But I think, again, it's really important for our efforts to be as open as we can to the public to make sure they do have an opportunity, because it's such an important task that we have. So with that, I certainly would like to leave it open if we do decide on an extension of 30 more days, which is
legally, I don't think you can leave open a closing comment date. You can, I guess, legally extend that's what we're discussing here. But there's no, you can't have, I believe this is correct, Chris, can you have an indefinite submission date?
No. I didn't mean it.
I think she means that you always have the discretion
exactly.
to go and ask.
Exactly. It's discretion of the council. Yeah. No, it would be 90 days, but the fact that we have the discretion of opening it again or longer is what I meant.
Well, obviously, am I correct, Mr. Stevens, that let's say we did a comment period for 90 days, another 30 days today, a council member could at any time move to extend beyond that, I assume. That's what, I'm sorry, now I misunderstood you. Okay. All right. Well, Don, I'm sorry.
Well, I just say, and I appreciate the comments from my colleagues and the timeliness, and Mr. Chair, you've certainly been, very good at, trying to keep us on task here, certainly meeting legislative mandates, but also I think, recognizing some of the practicalities. But I just see this as being important enough, and I think we all do, and again, that's not what time extension is necessarily about. And I'm not unappreciative of the fact that folks are willing to extend. I think that any extension is going to be beneficial here. I just feel strong enough about it that I think it ought to be 60 days. And so if there's a motion to go to 30, I'm not going to support that motion, not because I don't want to extend it, but I feel strong enough that we ought to go to the 60 days. And I appreciate what Gloria said, that we always have a chance to revisit this if we're if the volume is such or people make an additional plea to us. But I think from the get-go, not to assume that we just put time on the calendar to allow more time. I just think the magnitude, and it's not lost on any of us in this room, as you said a moment ago, people have been following this for 17 months and they've invested significant time and resources both to analyzing but to weighing in on it. And I just think for the magnitude, and I would just to the one comment that Mr. Kutras made, again, not lost on any of us, but this plan is for well in the future. I mean, there's not going to be anybody in this room probably is going to be back to visit us in 100 years and say, how did we do on all this? And so I just think keeping that in mind, recognizing that it can be amended and changed over time, it is historic in that aspect. And I think giving the additional time, not to delay, not to miss statutory mandates and so forth. And so I feel strongly it ought to be the 60-day extension, and maybe that comes from a perspective where the local government at times we get those appeals, and I've been inclined over the years to offer extension when it makes good sense. And in this case, I think it makes good sense. 30 days obviously is better than none, but I think 60 days is optimal.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Chris. I'm going to ask for a motion.
Yeah, it depends on how formal you want to get here, but if there was a motion.
No, if we want to talk about and actually set a new comment deadline, we
it would
want
be direction to staff to do that, and I don't know if we've
okay,
we
well, let's just see on a motion. Ms. Marcus.
Make the motion that Gloria made earlier for a 30-day.
90 days in total
from
November 4, 2011, direct the staff to recognize, what's the right wording, Chris?
We will issue supplemental notices as appropriate to add an additional 30 days at your direction, if that's your desire.
Okay. Good. Okay. All right. Got the motion, second. Any discussion, questions? Let's take a vote on that, starting with Ms. Gray.
Aye.
Aye.
Marcus, aye.
Fiorini, yes.
Eisenberg, aye.
I totally know.
Okay. Okay.
Can I just reiterate the fact that it's still, we still have the discretion of the council
to
extend it based on public comment. Thank you.
I know you will be watching. Okay, thank you very much. All right, now we went 30 minutes beyond our schedule. Chris, let me ask you a question. We've noticed the EIR hearing starting at 1 o'clock. If I'm going to tell all my colleagues in the audience they have to get back here in 29 minutes, I'm prepared to do it, or is it legally permissible to start at 1:30?
No, we'll start at the scheduled time, but if somebody wants to take a longer lunch, they obviously have a 3.5-hour period in which to present.
Okay, members, we're going to be back at 1 o'clock. Ladies and gentlemen, my apologies. 1 o'clock, we'll start up. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the Delta Stewardship Council is called back to order. We are now on our agenda, item 10, which is the first of several hearings we'll be conducting to receive public comment on the environmental impact report. And Mr. Stevens, there are a couple people who were not here this morning who've just shown up, so maybe you just restate your understanding and your direction to the council and to the staff and all of that on the process.
That's right. I'd be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we said before, and as the people in the audience are probably aware because they're here to provide testimony on the EIR, the Delta Stewardship Council did issue a draft programmatic environmental impact report on November 4th. It was for a 60-day comment period ending January 3rd. However, at the meeting a few minutes ago, the council took action and directed staff to add an extra 30 days to that comment period. So staff will be providing... Totaling 90 days. We'll be providing a supplemental notice to that effect. As the chair said, this is the first of two currently scheduled, although we may schedule some additional opportunities to provide oral testimony. This is the first of two that were scheduled. And when we talk about the opportunity to provide testimony on the EIR, I think that requires a bit of clarification. We talk about a hearing, but in effect, this is going to be an opportunity to provide one-way testimony in the presence of a court reporter who's sitting over to my left. And those comments, what we are inviting is comments on the environmental assessment that is contained in our draft environmental impact report that was issued on November 4th. What we are not inviting comment and at this time, and comment is not appropriate on the policies that are contained in the fifth staff draft. Substantive comments on the policies, there's a separate process for the stakeholders and the public to comment on that. And this hearing, again, is a one-way communication from members of the public that will allow then staff to take comments and provide responses in the form of written responses in a final environmental impact report, which will then be presented back to the council for its review and discretion as to whether or not they wish to certify that document. So when we refer to the hearing we're currently sitting at right now, scheduled from 1 to 4:30. What we are talking about is an opportunity for the public, again, to provide testimony before a court reporter. These will be part of the administrative record on the draft EIR. They should be comments on the environmental assessment contained in the EIR. Again, we will then, as required by CEQA, provide responses to the comments in the final environmental impact report. Okay. So with that, I turn it back over to the chair.
Okay. And ladies and gentlemen, as with all testimony to the council, it would be appreciated if you fill out and print in clear blocks your name, if you represent an organization, your organization, and identify the focus of your issues if it's possible to do so. We have one request. We'll take them in order in which they are received. And the first is from Mr. Bert Wilson. Mr. Wilson, good to see you again.
Oh, thank you for this opportunity. What I have to say may violate some of the rules which you just laid down, but that's too bad. Number one on the preface, the co-equal goals. The co-equal goals are not co-equal. They are what is called a logical fallacy in any school of rhetoric. They appear to be logical at first glance, but underneath they are mutually exclusive. You cannot save the delta by taking more water from the delta. Delta water diversions are what brought on the crisis today. Number two, moving forward, line 32, water legislation in 2009. The Delta Plan is a creation of the state legislature, which has been written into law in the form of the State Water Code. This says, in effect, that the state knows what's best for all the people of California on this sensitive issue. The original water plan was supposed to be a statewide ballot issue in 2010, but was taken off the ballot. Now the state is not allowing the people to vote on the cost of it or any part of it. This is deplorable. With the Delta Plan skirting the democratic process, it projects the feeling that something nefarious is going on, that it's really in the best interest of the Southland water districts and contractors and Beg Ag. We need a statewide referendum on at least the conveyance systems to be proposed by the Delta Plan. If conveyance and its costs were on the ballot in 1982, they should be on the ballot in 2012. Number three, Chapter 2, Science and Adaptive Management. Let's face it, adaptive management is just a fancy pseudonym for crisis management. This is an admission that you really don't know what will happen when you build conveyance systems that are subject to earthquakes and other environmental dangers. In this respect, to protect the Delta, no conveyance systems should be built. Number four, Chapter 3, line 27, incorporation of another plan into the Delta Plan. In my opinion, if there is anything that makes the Delta Plan look like a Rube Goldberg cartoon, it's the existence of the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. The BDCP, which has never been able to get its act together, is wasting time and money in hopes the DSC will give it its blessing. The whole situation is contrary to good management. Number five, Chapter 4, A More Reliable Water Supply for California. This heading, A More Reliable Supply for California, has gone through many changes. At first, in the Delta Vision Committee, it was merely A More Reliable Water Supply. Later, For the State was included. This is merely DSC code for sending more water south. The whole EIR plan is built around sending more water to the Southland. Number six, Chapter 9, Finance Plans, line 20. The beneficiaries' pay option is simply crazy. This would give all the water agencies and water contractors the ability to raise water rates with impunity. It is clear that the DSC does not want to incur public wrath with a bond issue because it wouldn't pass. So instead of raising taxes to pay bonded indebtedness, they want to push it off onto the water agencies and contractors, so they will have to raise rates and incur the public wrath. This is another aspect of the Delta Plan that defies comprehension unless one understands that the DSC is trying to skirt the democratic process in California and keep costs away from a public vote. Lastly, page 124, the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. which should really be called the Bay Delta Conveyance Plan, because that's the focus of the organization. The water delivery systems in California are already the state's biggest power users. Who's going to pay for that? I see this as a political move by the DSC, the inclusion, not inclusion of the Bay Delta Plan or any conveyance system in this environmental report, to avoid scrutiny by the people of California and to influence a positive response to this EIR. There needs to be more light shined on the BDCP and more transparency applied to their conveyance options and why. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Any other blue forms? No. Anyone else like to speak on this issue? Yes, Mr. Rentz, if you'd please come forward. And I'll collect your blue form up here, if you don't mind. Good to see you again.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Delta Stewardship Council members, Mark Rentz from the Association of California Water Agencies. First of all, my apologies that I was unable to attend earlier today. It is my understanding, I can be correct if I was wrong, that you did extend the comment period. So our appreciation to you for that. We're delving into the massive document, right, as is everybody. And so the comments I present today are initial comments based on a very initial review, and we'll provide you more detailed comments. Also, for the record, and for those who are not aware, I'm here today speaking on the behalf of the Ag Urban Coalition.
Okay.
Though I work for AQUA, and just as a piece of background, the Ag Urban Coalition consists of more than 80 water agencies, agricultural business and water organizations, and local governments located both above, within, and below the Delta. It's an expansive group of water experts that came together and spent a long time deliberating and has come together to provide a unified perspective on addressing California's urgent water challenges, the reason we're all here today. It is dedicated to the concurrent advancement of both the co-equal goals, and that is statewide water supply reliability and restoration of the Bay Delta ecosystem. And as you all know, but again for the record, we did submit a 50-plus page alternate plan that you have included in the draft EIR. We appreciate that as a standalone alternative. I'm providing today some very general, basic comments based on my quick review of what I could get through on the DEIR. But as you know, throughout the course of our deliberations that we've had an opportunity, and we appreciate the opportunity to come before you and share with you our thoughts and comments on the various iterations of the draft plan, there have been several policy concerns that we have raised time and time again, and we still feel they haven't been addressed in either the plan, and so consequently have not been addressed in the DEIR, and that's what some of my comments are today. But, you know, as the coalition met to discuss about our very preliminary review of it, we were quite disappointed with the draft environmental impact report for many reasons, which I'd like to share with you now. A couple of them is, first of all, you know, we were quite surprised that we have a 2,200-page plus environmental analysis, yet the analysis does not include any type of assessment of the staff's draft Delta plan or any of the alternates in the context of the co-equal goals. Yet this is the very basic objectives that were set forth in the legislation that gave rise to the Delta Stewardship Council, and so it's hard for us to understand how this environmental document and environmental analysis can really fulfill its responsibilities under CEQA to provide an environmental analysis within the context of these most basic objectives absent that analysis. So that's one of our very preliminary concerns and significant concerns. On the other hand, we took great effort to, as we developed our 50-page alternate plan, it was a commitment to the advancement of the co-equal goals. And that was no easy commitment given the array of participants in that development. And we were committed to an integrated, systematic, and scientific approach that addresses the potential relationships between and among the various ecosystem stressors in the Delta and promotes coordinated activities, actions amongst the dozens of agencies that have statutory and regulatory responsibilities within the Delta. And, you know, that the DEIR, from our perspective, failed to accurately describe our plan from that perspective. And it failed to analyze our plan in this context, both the context of the co-equal goals and some of the foundational cornerstones that we laid out in the plan about an integrated, comprehensive approach and a coordinated effort amongst the agencies. Some of our initial thoughts on the DEIR's environmental analysis is we do not believe that the Delta plan will restore the environment faster or better than the alternate plan. As we read it, the Delta plan's key ecosystem tools are flow objectives that lead to a more natural flow regime in the Delta. Yet there's no definition, as we could find, at least preliminarily, in the DEIR or the Delta plan as to what constitutes natural flow regimes. And there's no discussion as to the environmental effects in the DEIR, which is its charge, as to the effects both within and beyond the Delta associated with such an approach. So again, we think that that is a significant environmental analysis that is lacking. Second of all, we don't believe that the Delta plan will improve supply, water supply reliability statewide, obviously one of the cornerstone co-equal goals of your mission. The Delta plan concludes that water would continue to be available, but at a reduced amount. The Delta plan assumes, without any demonstrable basis, that this significant impact will be mitigated. In other words, water suppliers throughout the state will develop alternative water supplies. Well, the analysis is yet to discuss how that will happen and as to the whether it's feasible and what the environmental impacts may be associated with such an approach, and therefore the environmental analysis in the DER, we think, is incomplete. Finally, we believe that the DEIR analysis as to how the Delta plan will best coordinate its efforts to achieve the co-equal goals is not accomplished. Again, as I mentioned, this was one of the cornerstones of the analysis we did. This was one we think is one of the most crucial roles that this Delta Stewardship Council can provide, and that's to help facilitate and, where appropriate, coordinate and synthesize actions amongst all these agencies that have responsibility in part or in whole in the Delta to ensure that as we move forward, given our limited resources that we all have, whether you're government, water agencies or the private sector, NGOs, that we are working in a manner that's coordinated that most effectively and efficiently uses those resources. The staff's Delta plan doesn't even address that issue, and the DER ignores that this is one of the key cornerstones of our plan. That is our preliminary assessment. We will provide you more details. We appreciate this opportunity today. I guess in closing, the one thing I would encourage each of you council members is to please take the time to look at our 50-page alternate plan that we put forward. We think the fact that we brought together the extensive and knowledge to formulate this plan is a great tool for you, a great advantage, a great opportunity for you, which we hope in reading and studying our plan you will see is an opportunity that you should take advantage of. Thank you for the time, Mr.
Thank Chairman. You, Mr. Rentz. Members, I should probably note for the court reporter that our colleague, Mr. Fiorini, is seated in the audience, feeling perhaps that the atmosphere is more rarefied there than elsewhere, and he's getting a new perspective on things. So, all right. Okay, do we have other speakers? Is there anyone else that would like to talk to the council on the environmental impact report? Yes, sir. Ah, there you go. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board.
I'm sorry, this is Jim Verboon. Jim Verboon. He's been here many times before representing his position to the council. Thank you for coming again. Thank you again for coming.
You're welcome. As a salmon fisherman and a farmer, I'm very interested in its outcome here. One of the things that the EIR, I think, needs to address is, I think, to properly look at the environment, the point of diversion for the state and federal pumps is Sherman Island at the confluence of the two rivers rather than out of the Delta. Because the water comes from the Sacramento River, it is transported to the pumps via the San Joaquin River. So where exactly is that point of diversion at today? And I would profess that that point of diversion is Sherman Island, the confluence of the rivers. And Another interesting thing is that I would like the Delta Plan to consider some diversions and interconnections between the San Joaquin River and the Sacramento River upstream through potentially existing facilities, Snodgrass Slough, the deep water channel that that brings water upstream from the pumps. It would give you potentially a downstream positive flow 100% of the time, either that or it's going to bring salinity far enough up to where the pumps are going to shut off so that you're only going to pump the amount of water that's really there. So anyway, those are the two things that I kind of wanted to reiterate. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Verbaugh. Is there anyone else who would like to talk to the council on the environmental impact report? Is there anyone else? Going once. Nope, here we are. Yes, ma'am. Please come forward, identify yourself, and before you get out of here, if you'd print a blue form for us so our court reporter can check the spellings of the names and get everything accurate. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Becky Linville. I'm an environmental scientist. My focus is on water quality issues. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak here today, and thank you for the draft EIR, which is looking at both co-equal goals. I would like to emphasize my support for both of those goals. I think both are extremely important to the state, especially given the current situation and given our future situation with the potential for the bay to rise. My understanding is that the city of San Francisco is planning for 13-inch rise by the year 2050. And I see in your draft EIR that that amount may change to 55 inches by the end of the century. So that's a huge issue. I would also like to request information in the EIR on daily tidal water levels and how the low tides and the high tides affect that. I've heard recently that in Sacramento Harbor, the water levels can change up to 5 feet in one day. And my understanding is that south of the deep water channel, it's influenced less by the tides. But at the northern end of the deep water channel, there's a huge influence there. And my suspicion is that there would be other areas in the delta where the tides would affect the water levels differently. So I would like information on that and how any proposed water conveyance systems would affect the Sacramento Harbor, as well as how does that affect water flows for the salmon that are migrating up the Sacramento River. Another huge concern that I have is liquefaction of soils during an earthquake. My understanding from your draft EIR information that's in Chapter 11 is that in the past, the soil dropped 11 feet in Sassoon Marsh during the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, but it only caused a 3-foot change in elevation 10 miles west of Stockton. So there are changes in the soil structure throughout the delta that could be affected by an earthquake by liquefaction when the soil essentially goes liquid. And I would like more information on that potential, especially if there are conveyance options that go through the west portion of the delta, through the middle of the delta, and through the east part of the delta. I did not see, I wasn't able to read all 2,000 pages, but I wasn't able to see information on how deep the proposed tunnel might be and whether that would be going through soils high in organic matter content or not. So all that I have is to go by is what's in Chapter 11. And that shows the soils at the surface and the organic mineral content at the surface. So if I just look at those maps and, you know, through my best judgment with no further information, my guess is that the eastern conveyance option is more stable during an earthquake. But like I said, I don't feel like I have all of that information. I don't know if I can get information on how deep the tunnel is being proposed today or not, but if I can, I would like that information as well. And lastly, I'd like to state that a lot of the press has focused on the Delta smelt and how, you know, it's an endangered species, and sometimes they seem to trivialize the Delta smelt. But scientists think of the Delta smelt as an indicator species of the entire health of the Delta ecosystem, and it's extremely important, not only as an endangered species, but for the health of the entire ecosystem. And the Delta is an incredible place, even today, even with all the changes that has gone through in its history. And to see 3-foot salmon migrate up the Sacramento River is really something. And I'm glad that that's one of the co-equal goals. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And before you get out of here, if you'd fill out one of these little blue forms that are kicking at the table and hand it to the lady over there, we'll have a permanent record of the correct spelling of your name. All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Anyone else want to talk to the council on the environmental impact report? Anyone else want to talk to the council on the environmental impact report? Okay. Members, it is
I'm sorry. I would recommend a couple things, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
First of all, we've noticed this public hearing from 1 to 4:30 as part of the transparency that you're all in favor of. We're committed to staying here with the court reporter until that time.
All right. I will stay. And I will stay here.
Not that any of the members are required to, because this hearing isn't required.
I understand. No, I will stay here.
So what I would recommend, perhaps, is if there's nobody here now that wants to testify mm-hmm. on the EIR, that we adjourn that part and that you take public comment, which is on your agenda, on any
generalized comment.
Generalized public comment. But we are committed to staying here. The court reporter is okay. Until 4:30 to take comments.
All right, let's do that then. Let me just ask once again, anyone want to speak to us on the environmental impact report? On the environmental impact report. All right, at the suggestion of legal counsel, is there any objection to closing the hearing on file item number 10 at this time, subject to be reopened should other parties appear between now and 4:30 wishing to testify on the EIR? Any objection? Any objection? Without objection, the hearing is closed. Folks who are left in the audience, is there anyone who wants to talk to us on anything else? Now's the time. How was the atmosphere and rarefied air of the audience?
I could hear better out there.
Well, that's something. That's something. Okay, I see no, I'm sorry, Joe.
I wanted to, if we may, I'd like to follow up with the field hearing discussion. Kind of, I gathered from all of you after you voted to go to a 30-day extension and the discussion that Mr. Natoli brought up about a hearing in the Delta, my thought was that we should schedule five field hearings in the north part of the state, the Delta, the Valley, and two in urban Southern California, so that's five hearings. And my sense was, since we extended the date by 30 days, that we should do that after the first of the year. That gives us enough time to have a hearing, say, in the first or second week of the year, and for people then to have a couple of weeks still to do any written comments. And so I want to check with you to make sure that's okay.
Here's my suggestion. You've got the authorization of the council for comment period extension for another 30 days, 90 in total. You have general support in the council on, what did you call these? Not scoping meetings. These are, what's
field
the?
Hearings.
Field hearings. Field hearings. You have general counsel support for the two that you have previously identified that are noticed in the material that was used today on the environmental impact report. And I think it's fair to say we're sympathetic to additional ones. But I think you want to consider for a day or two the timing, the scheduling, the location, as opposed to ask us to formally approve those today when you may want to change them depending on availability
of space.
Well, and
I don't have the details, so okay. We will have to work on those. But yeah. I did want general consensus that's something that we should work on.
I notice Mr. Natoli's nodding his head yes, as do I. And any objection to that? No objection noted by the members, six members of the council who are here. Okay.
Thank you.
All right, we're going. Mr. Wilson, stand up and use the microphone if you would, please. This is Mr. Burt Wilson from Carmichael, who has spoken previously today.
Would you describe for me, for all of us, the process of what's going to happen with the BDCP conveyance recommendations? Are they going to be included in the Delta plan sometime in March, and then it'll be just one environmental plan after June?
Well, let's see. Mr. Stevens, may I simply read the statute? Well, Mr. Wilson, let me tell you what the statute says about the Delta Plan and its relationship to the Bay Delta Conservation Plan. It says, the Bay Delta Conservation Plan shall be considered for inclusion in the Delta Plan in accordance with this chapter. That's the chapter of the 2009 Act on Governance. That's A. B. The BDCP shall not be incorporated into the Delta Plan, and the public benefits associated with the BDCP shall not be eligible for state funding unless BDCP does all of the following.
They have to meet certain requirements.
Yeah, but they're important requirements.
Yeah, I know.
The first requirement is the Natural Communities Conservation Planning Act. The second is meeting CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act. They must also consider, let's see, I'll get you the right language, including review and analysis of all of the following: a reasonable range of flow criteria, rates of diversion, and other operational criteria required to satisfy the criteria for approval of a natural communities conservation plan as provided in the code
now,
section.
Are they going to give you a document and you're going to vet it?
Then I'll jump to the last end. When they conclude their work, and their present schedule says they will have a preliminary draft, I think is the way they're phrasing it, out sometime in 2013. It's unclear when that would be formally adopted. And the law then says, the last step in that process, by the way, is the State Department of Fish and Game must certify, prove, that yeah. BDCP has met all these tests of law. And the law says, if the Department of Fish and Game approves the BDCP as a natural communities conservation plan and determines that BDCP meets the requirements of this section, all the other things, and the BDCP has been approved as a habitat conservation plan, that's federal law, pursuant to the Federal Endangered Species Act, the council shall incorporate BDCP into the Delta plan. Period. Last sentence. The Department of Fish and Game's determination that the Bay Delta Conservation Plan has met the requirements of this section may be appealed to the council.
Now, when the BDC plan is incorporated into the Delta plan,
if it meets the test of law, yes.
Are you then going to produce one gigantic environmental impact report?
No, sir.
For everything?
No, sir. BDCP will have its own environment.
They're going to have their own environment.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay.
They're required to do that.
Well, I'm glad they included the no option.
That's required under, Mr. Stevens, correct me if I'm wrong. All projects under California law evaluated by the Environmental Quality Act must include a no project alternative as our environmental impact.
Well, it wasn't for a long time.
Okay. anyway, so that's what the law said. By the way, that's Water Code Section 85320, and it's a very important section.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
Phil.
You, sir.
Okay.
Okay, anyone else like to talk to the council on anything? All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a recess, I guess is the correct way to phrase it. Mr. Stevens and the court reporter and I will hang around until our announced time of 4:30, a duty which will be assigned out in the future to others on the council sitting here. But it goes to show you, this same thing happened at one or two of our scoping meetings, and I didn't remember. Goes to show you, I sat for those too. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. We're in recess. We'll see you tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., for our regular meeting agenda that we're going to roll through. Anything else on tomorrow, Mr. Grindstaff?
It will be an interesting day. We have a discussion on BDCP. We have an intense discussion about stressors. So I expect a very good meeting tomorrow morning.
Okay. Thank you. Tell me when. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, the Elder Stewardship Council is called back into order. We recessed, Madam Reporter, I think you indicated at 1:36 in the afternoon. Continuously since that time, either myself, Ms. Marcus, or Mr. Fiorini have been here in the meeting room. Court Reporter's been here. Mr. Chris Stevens, our General Counsel, has been here along with other staff. And we're even being observed by Mr. Pete Koutras from the County Coalition, who is hanging around here, too. No one has requested the opportunity to speak. There is no one else here. This notice is for purposes of the record, and we will keep the proceeding running without additional further comment until 4:30 exactly, and we will at that time announce that the meeting is adjourned to the next subsequent meeting on the environmental impact report. Mr. Stevens, is that a proper recitation?
Yep.
Okay. All right. We're going to wait 4 minutes. 1 minute. Six seconds more. Okay, members, the hour of 4:30 having arrived, the door to the hearing room has been open, and we see no other people wishing to testify on the environmental impact report. The hearing is adjourned. We'll see you tomorrow morning for a regular meeting of the council, 9 a.m. Thank you very much for staying. Madam Recorder, thank you.